William, you waited until after the record? You couldn't do it beforehand? You absolutely gross human. I had to listen to that? I've been assaulted.
For those wondering, that was notes of pizza and Coke.
Murder me. Hi, guys, and welcome to another episode of your favorite podcast, Unresolved Textual Tension. It's me, your hostess with the mostest, Maria, and today I have my ruggedly handsome co-host, William.
What's up, guys? Extra rugged, extra handsome.
And extra and gross.
We don't know if that's going to be the cold open or not, so if it isn't, you guys should just know that Maria has weird standards of bodily hygiene that she tries to keep me to. And today we are not doing one book, we are doing four. And what four are those, Maria?
We are doing Garth Nix's Keys to the Kingdom, Mr. Monday, Grim Tuesday, Drowned Wednesday, and Sir Thursday. A couple of people during our latest big live stream asked if we were planning to do some what kind of
YA, I think.
Young YA, middle grade, I think is a term that gets used for it. Like young adult books for like 12 and 13 year olds. Like that like a fourth
grader. For actual
grader.
Young adults instead of 30-year-old women who want smut.
And also for like kids. Like I could see a fifth grader reading this book.
Yes, very much so.
And reading it. And this is also a trip down memory lane. It is part of our nostalgia series. Nostalgia reads. We don't actually have a name for that series, but it should be in a playlist somewhere.
And the thing is, Garth Nix is a writer who we both really like. He's so talented. And this series, and then he had one before this called the Seventh Tower series that was also part of a chapter, kind of. So I should mention this because I don't think these are really done anymore, this genre or format of book, which is that it was like a lot of short books. So Animorphs is the one a lot of people know. Me and Katie had done the Remnant series. And so like this is actually one of the few books I have. It's like this is actually significantly longer. Usually it would be soft cover and it would only be like half this length, and like each of them isn't very long, but they add up to a greater story. And I had read a ton of those as a kid, and this is one of the ones I read as I kind of aged out of that era, because I read these as they came out. And I really liked the first four or five, and then six and seven get a little bit weird, I think. But Maria hasn't read those, right?
No, I think I read, in retrospect, I think I have read the Friday book. I just don't remember anything about it. But no, I own all of the books. Like they're there somewhere. I think on this side. On this side, somewhere in this region, they're there. They exist. And so I know I bought them all, but then I think like it just hit, cuz didn't the last one come out in like age?
I think so. No, hold on. No, you would have still been young because I'm like 4 years older than you, and okay, I was like still like whatever. But very quickly, well, Maria looks up to figure out how ancient she is because she can't tell through the rings. Because to be able to tell how old she is, she would have to cut like open her finger and then measure the rings like they do with trees to figure out how old she is. And so very quickly, the synopsis of this, because we've been told we need to do synopsis earlier in the videos, is that this is what if heaven was a bunch of British people? And that's how I probably will name this episode.
That is the worst. At no point did I think of, oh, this is heaven. At no point did I even remotely make this connection. Like, is the mechanics of the universe British? Yes. Is heaven British? No. No, sir. There's nothing about the house, or is the heaven British? There's nothing about the house that makes me think of heaven.
Well, but it's like the celestial framework that God created.
It was right before I graduated. It came out, the last book came out in 2010.
So 13 years ago now.
Yeah, so I was 14. Finishing up high school at that point, almost. I had one more year to go by that point. And so I just, like, I don't remember why, but I didn't finish it, I don't think. Unless I just really don't remember the last three books, in which case, maybe, but I won't say that I did. But anyway, it's not heaven. It don't listen to William. William
it's
likes to be
snappy.
It's
the celestial framework of the universe that God created is British people.
Yes, that's a better That's a better
Okay, all right. How would you give the premise of this then?
I would say that. I would say, like I said, the universal the universal mechanics, and by mechanics I mean like people are British, and it has a bureaucracy, and it's organized around 7 days. It's so this is kind of like a mythology book, but a made up mythology book. It feels like it is working within an established mythos with like figures and then sub figures and like rhyme or reason to it, and then this is an extrapolation of that, but it's not like Garth Nix made this up. But it definitely has that vibe. There are characters that are going to remind you of Greek mythology. There are calls to like a Judeo-Christian ideas of stuff, but it definitely is like that. And it's like there's our world, and then there's the house, and the house is the celestial. What was the term you used?
Structure, basically.
Celestial framework.
Basically, there was the architect who was God, but they don't call her God. And she created the secondary realms, which is the universe. And that's like where humans are. And then she created the house.
No, the house was first.
Okay.
Well, she made the house out of nothingness, then the secondary. That's why they're called the secondary realms, because it wasn't the first one she made.
Their main job, though, is to just
observe,
record what happens in the secondary realms and record it. And so that's what it is. And what's great about it is that they're all in like 1920s Britishness. Like they all wear like top hats and suits. And I like the idea that like they lag behind our history by like a few hundred years in terms of like their fashion. And they're just the thing that Garth Nix does. And the reason that I kept reading these past a certain point is just because his world building is so effing cool. It's so, it's just incredibly cool because, like, so for example, in this world, like, everything is made from nothing. Nothing is a substance that will both kind of, is kind of like an acid, but if you want to create something, you have to draw it from nothing, which is like, you know, that's just such a clever reference to the whole like God created the world from nothing type of an idea. There's instead at one point we meet a Prometheus figure who, instead of having vultures take out his liver, he's on a big clock, and two cuckoos with drills come out every
one with a drill and one with a hatchet,
yeah, and they cut off his eyes, and like it's so there's just like little details like that throughout, and the internal logic of it is really consistent, and it's so much fun to go through.
And the basic premise, so you have this framework, and the basic idea of this series is there is a 12-year-old boy who, through a happenstance of fate, ends up being the inheritor of the architect's will. And the idea was a heckin' long time ago, like a real heckin' long time ago, the architect did a poof and disappeared and left behind her will, and about how everything was supposed to be run. But her seven trustees,
each of which controls one day. They so like Sir Monday, Sir Thursday can only control things in the outer realms on Thursday.
And the trustees decided, no, I don't want to listen to your fucking will, architect. It's a dumb fucking will. So they broke up the will. They hid it in each of their respective realms, in the house, and they were like, no, not today. And our poor main character, Arthur, as he nearly dies when he's like 12 years old, ends up becoming, through one of the will pieces escaping, the inheritor of the house, all the realms, the whole shablammy, which means he now has to day by day go challenge the trustees, get their respective keys, and collect all the seven pieces of the will to bring forth the will of the architect and like right the wrongs that the trustees have been doing for the past like bajillion millennia.
Yeah, because the house is in basically disarray. It's kind of falling apart. And each of the trustees is one of the Catholic cardinal sins. So Monday is sloth, Tuesday is greed, Wednesday is gluttony. And then Thursday is anger. Which, and like each of them also has like a piece of the key that manages the house. Like, so it's basically like a super cool. Honestly, as I was reading this, I was like, man, this should be a video game. This would be so cool.
It would be an insane video. It's so funny you said that. I had the exact same thought. And so I imagine for kids growing up with RPG video games that have that level structure, the collection of pieces and going through something, this is like that. Almost to a T. There are NPCs that show up at certain points, at specific points in the narrative when you need like a little boost to get you to the next plot point. And each level looks different and has a different feel. Like level one
A
is
different
like,
mechanic. Thursday has a maze that keeps changing position
and
every
is
hour.
army themed. Wednesday was the ocean and sailors and pirates. And so it feels like a video game in the sense that like as you progress through the levels, you're like, this is the water level. This is the jungle level. You know, not that there's been a jungle realm, but that's the vibe you get. And I think that is a really interesting way of thinking about this book series. And it very much Will made the comment of those really short, like the Animorphs series, where it was tiny sections of a whole greater story versus like now most of the books we read, it's like three books and they're chonky boys and it's a trilogy and it's done. And this is more like bit by bit by bit. And I love that because I don't know if I've mentioned it on this channel at all ever, but I fucking love a small scope, man. I love going into a book and the book going, this is what we're gonna do. And then that's what we do. And it doesn't like, there's not 900 arcs and many fucking climaxes. And this series really like nails that. But yeah, it's the world building is really, it's crazy. If you thought to yourself, how do you go from like a pirate world to like a moving maze a la Cube with an army? Like, what's the Nyx makes it work. When I tell you it shouldn't, there's so much odd shit, guys. There's so much odd shit. And I think the first book is probably for people getting into the series the hardest one to get into because you have to buy into a certain level of absurdity and just.
The tone is very specific, and if you're not there for that tone, it's not going to work for you. So, like, one of the things is that you're very distanced in terms of the narrative from, in terms of narrative distance with the character. Arthur feels kind of far away, which makes sense because, again, this is not a young adult book for adults. This is a young adult book for young adults. Like, this is, he is writing to an audience that is younger. And
And
also, this kind of jives
preteens.
with his, yeah, and preteens. Arthur Penhaligon is not a cool, sexy 18-year-old. He is 12 and he has asthma. This kind of jives very well with Nyx's style in general. One of the things we talked about in Left-Handed Booksellers of London and Sabriel, go check them out here or here.
If he actually does it, he lies. He says he's going to do it, and then he's like, during that's how I imagine him during the editing process. Like he's going to pass this portion of the video and be like, "Hey, motherfuckers, it ain't happening." That's my Will impression.
Uncanny, uncanny. You should be on SNL. And so, like, this jives very well because those books also were kind of detached and far away in terms of the narrative voice. But here it works really well. The thing about it is that, yeah, these books are really cool because of the world building and the action. He's really good at writing action, actually. Like, each time, me and Maria both had this going on where, like, because we read these in between other books for the last, like, 2 months, we kept being like, oh, yay, we don't have to listen to that other book. We can listen to this one.
There literally was a point where, like, Will was like, you know, I don't feel well. You know, maybe you and Katie can do this one book. And I was like, buddy, don't worry about it. Let's just reschedule. Like, it's fine. Everyone's gonna be okay. You need time off too, my guy, because Katie and I have had to move stuff around the schedule way more than Will. And I was like, you do. And in my head, I was like, do it so I can go back to reading Wednesday, because it's just so gripping. And at the time, I was reading Divine Rivals, and I was like, I'd much rather read Wednesday. So it's fun. It's fun. It's a little frothy in the sense that there's a lightness to it. There's an airiness. There's a lot of weird and kind of fucked up shit that happens, but it never like gut punches you. You're never just left horrified staring at what's happening. It's kind of like if this got turned into a movie series or a TV show, I imagine it would be way scarier and emotionally a bit more emotionally impactful, depending on how the director and scriptwriter chose to do it, because there's a lot of elements in here that are just there's a mustache
Oh
slug
yeah.
with suckers on the
That's the
bottom.
best. I thought it was a caterpillar, but you're right, it is actually one of
It
the slugs.
is, and in the book, it's just like, oh, that's kind of weird. Oh, I don't like the pucker noise it makes. But if you were the right filmmaker and you were like, we're gonna lean into like. Murder me.
Tim Burton wishes he could. And that's the thing. And going back to the readability, like I read all of Sir Thursday on Monday. I started it and I was like, no, I'm not going to stop. I really like this. It helps. It's the most military themed one, and I love military history and like fiction, but it's so enjoyable is just the word for it. So we're probably not going to have any like super deep commentary, but I do think there are things that Nix does that are really smart in how he writes the book so it
Yes.
can work.
I am definitely going to have some things that for me were harder to get into now as an adult, and also some ways in which I wish it had a little bit more of a few things. So I will have some things in which I think it could have been improved, and in ways that I think like a preteen audience also would have enjoyed.
Like the narrator not having a terrible voice for Cersei Turquoise Blue, one of my favorite characters.
So there's that, but also like just trusting children to process emotions, because unfortunately the one of the side effects of having such a distant narrative is there are scenes where you're like, oh man, that should have been very affecting, and it's not, and you get the vibe that because it's being written for a younger audience that he's not going as deep into those things as he could have, and I think that's a disservice to the audience of children that might read it. Like, I definitely think having a moment of, there's one character, one of the trustees that our boy Arthur has to go up against, that ends up being a very sympathetic character, and she ends up having a really terrible fate in the end. And I was like, oh my god, that's ter-. But the narrative was just like, oh no, that sucked. She wasn't that bad, you know? Like, and there's no emotionality to it. And again, I'm going to define, when I say the term emotionality, I mean inspiring emotion out of the reader, not necessarily that that Arthur is going, no. How could this? I'm not talking about the characters having emotions and displaying emotions. I'm talking about something in the narrative inspiring emotion in you outside of the, because sometimes narratives will go, and it was sad, and you're like, okay, it was a sad scene. It is telling you it is sad, versus it making you feel sad for what is happening. One is a description, and one is inspiring emotionality and giving emotionality. I will die on
The
this
two are
hill.
somewhat connected, but they are kind of, that's a good way of looking at them. I think a good way of giving a sense of a tone is that in Sir Thursday, there's a part where Leaf, who's a secondary character, meets an old lady in our world, right? And she needs to convince her about the house. And the old lady is like, I don't believe that. And Leaf is like, ugh, fine. And she gives her these glasses so that she can see the house. We'll talk about this later, but she can see a supernatural thing. And the old lady is like, oh, I wish you were making that up. Okay, and then she's devoted to the plan, and that's kind of the
Devoted.
level. Yeah.
Yes.
Like that's kind of the level of reality and character we're working with is that, you know, in real life this should create like, oh my God, a bunch of Sturm und Drang and like, you know, upsetness and questioning of existence, like all that stuff, but like this is like it's realistic, so there's a cause and effect which makes the book work and makes the characters feel real, but it's not going for a super realistic tone.
It's not at all. It definitely has a bit of, like, I would say a British absurdist
Yes.
a thing going for it, where like the things that are happening are absurd, but the characters are rolling with it and going with it, and it again, it is perfectly encapsulated where this is like grand stakes of the universe. Grand stakes of the universe. I'm talking, there's a couple of, like, there's literally a point where they were like, if this thing happens, your world is also going kaput. Just kablammy. And the guy they chose was a 12-year-old kid who, for the most part, they just throw into shit by himself. All these 1,000-year-old beings are like, good luck, Arthur!
I said in Left-Handed Booksellers of London and Sabriel that Garth Nix, despite I think being Australian, is really good at writing like Britishness and British characters who like have that absurdity poshness about them, and like this is just so on full effect within this series. But we should get started. So, who is Arthur and how does Monday start?
Monday starts with seeing a piece of the will escape, which starts giving you a tiny little taste of what the world looks like, because there's like, it's like a special realm and there's these big clockwork.
I wish I could quote it, because yeah, for a children's book, it's gnarly. They're describing this place out of time that's in the middle of nowhere where there's nine sentinels who've stood for 10,000 years without moving, and they'll cut down anyone who comes close unless they say the password at a specific time. And you're like, damn, son.
And it's all to guard this one fragment of the architect's will. And then this one incompetent, again, the absurdity, an incompetent paper pusher whose job it is to come and just make sure, like, it's an inspector to just come and go, okay, I see everything's here, the will's here, everyone, all the sentinels are here, everything's working, da-da-da, done. And he's, like, sweating and just, like, a bit incompetent. it's basically, like, the bumbling bureaucrat helps the will escape unknowingly, and the will is just a squiggle of text, and it like shoots off, and then everybody's like, oh shit, the will's missing. And that's how the book opens. And then we meet Arthur Penhaligon, who is our 12-year-old main character, who is, he is adopted into a larger family. His adoptive mother works in infectious diseases, and his birth parents had died of an outbreak of a very infectious disease, and they decided, because they knew Arthur, to adopt him. And one of the things the book mentions is that he's always felt very loved and at home with his adopted family, and so it gets mentioned sometimes, but most of the time he just refers to them as mom, dad, and his siblings. His dad was like an old rock star from like 20 years ago. Yeah, and then, and it's just, it's a nice little family who have enough uniqueness to them that you, like, remember them, but you don't spend a lot of time with them, so they're not the most fleshed out. We got more things to explore. Garth Nix knows what he's about.
I think this is actually a bit of a mistake on the part of the reader, because there's another character, Leaf, who's going to be doing, on the part of the author. There's another character, Leaf, who's going to be going back and forth helping with stuff all the time, and I really would have liked some Diana Wynne Jones family power.
Family! Thank stories, you! I was going to say that.
Yeah, and the thing is, because a lot of the siblings show up and they have a couple lines and then they leave, and with the distance tone, that's fine, it doesn't feel weird, but I really would have liked to see the siblings interact and be characters, and then that actually would have given a lot of stakes to what happens with Arthur and this world, because the problem these books are going to have, and it's not really a problem, but like, there's a bunch of C-plots about how what's happening in the house is affecting the modern, his, Arthur's world, and and like, I kept being like, okay, cool, but can we get back to the army made out of nothing horses? Like, come on.
And it's funny, because it definitely has a Monster of the Week, Mystery of the Week vibe. We're like, we know we're going to be dealing with the new weekday, but then what chaos is the house going to wreck upon the second week? Like, the first time it's like a plague, and then it's on Tuesday, it's like, we're repossessing all of your assets you're broke now. And then on Wednesday, I don't think there was anything.
No, it's
on
Leaf
Wednesday.
Leaf
gets sucked in, but nothing major. Because Wednesday,
and then Thursday,
night. And then
plague
Thursday,
again,
plague again, and a weird, the creepiest thing. The skinless boy is just, yo, he is. And when I tell you, Nix knows how to drop a tasty hook and not talk about it again for an entire book, and then it comes up, and you're like, oh, fuck, I forgot about that. And it's just terrifying. And so there's a little bit of that to it, where as you're reading, you're like, oh, how is, what
play? It's a very A-plot, B-plot kind of TV series type of a thing. Mm-hmm. And again, Leaf does a lot of the stuff, and she's fine, she's whatever, but like, I would have liked it if it had been his sister, because then it also would have given, because one of Arthur's big struggles throughout the book is that he just wants to go home and be normal. And so, like, that would have been a way of really tying and solidifying it for the reader.
I especially, like, I would have loved if at some point his mom ended up in it, you know? Or, like, his father. And, like, and it, there requires some, like, working together family. I agree. Mm-hmm. I really wanted his family. And also just because they seem like an interesting cast of characters. And I think that would have been a really just nice addition. So, same page, William.
It's too bad. I wanted us to disagree at some point so we could have nothing pistolas.
What are they called? The they have a specific name for their
He has such cool names for all of the equipment. Like there's like
yeah.
Midnight Scourges and Savage Swords and Electricity Tulwars and like all this cool shit.
There's so much, and I just can't remember that he had a term for like the kind of bullets they had. But
Oh yeah,
anyway,
because the bullets have to be made out of nothing so they'll eat
nothing.
through the denizens.
Yeah, it's so cool. There's so much interesting world building that builds on up from the one book to the next book to the next book, and it really works. And you also are learning more about the architect and like what was happening with her, and like finding out, like, you don't find out until halfway through that one of the people that you know is going to be one of the big bads is actually her son. And so it's super fascinating.
So what happens is that Arthur has pretty severe asthma. So
Yes.
he's at school and he's going for a run with everybody because the gym teacher is a dick. And he's like, "Oh, I don't have my inhaler." He starts to pass out and have an asthma attack. And as he's having this asthma attack, he sees an old guy in a wheelchair being pushed by another guy coming towards him. And he's
No,
like, "I'm
a young,
hallucinating."
beautiful guy being pushed by a really old guy.
I couldn't figure out which of them I should save first, so I kind of mixed the two up. But anyway, this is Sir Monday, or not Sir Monday, Mr. Monday
Mr.
being
Monday.
pushed by Sneezer, who is his butler. And basically, he is one of the trustees that we talked about. And basically, he gets annoyed because the will keeps telling him to give the key to the rightful owner. And so Sneezer, his butler, has convinced him that what he should do is he should give the key to a mortal who's about to die. And then the will will be fulfilled and it'll stop bothering him. And he mostly doesn't pay a lot of attention because his vice is sloth, and so he's very lazy. And what we find out is that actually Caesar is being manipulated by the part of the will that escaped. But anyway, so they give Arthur what looks like the small hand of a clock. And the thing is, once he picks it up, all of a sudden it reinvigorates him. His lungs start working again, and so he doesn't die. And then Monday is like, "I don't think you told me the truth. Let's go back and figure out what's going on in the house."
And also, Sneezer starts talking differently, and then Monday is like, J'accuse!
Yeah, exactly. It's like you have a frog in your
In your
throat, and
throat.
later we find out that the will is literally a frog who goes into people's throats,
Yes.
which is so funny.
And Arthur, some kids from school, one named Leaf, and I think her brother's Greg. Yeah, I don't know, but I'll go with Greg.
It's M.
Come. And he's at a new school. His family moves around a lot. And so he doesn't know these people, and they come and they're like, "Yo, buddy, you just about passed out. What happened?" And then Arthur's like, "I'm good. Like, it's fine. Don't worry. I got this weird key thing." Actually, he gets rushed, I think, to the hospital. No, not on this day. Anyway, there's a whole thing happens where Leaf later is like, "Yo, I saw these weird dog people sniffing around the place where you passed out." And he's like, "That's weird. I don't know about dog people." And then later, while he's at school, he gets, or something happens in his house where a flying dog person with like wings, but it's like, it looks like a person in a trench coat, but with a dog face, like think bulldog face and like a bowler hat, is like flying outside his window and like, and he's like, "What the fuck?" And he happened to, when he got the key, because he still, that key hand that he was given, the clock hand that he was given, he still has it. It just keeps following him around. And a book appeared, and he opened the book, and it was like, "That's a fetcher. And fetchers are from the house, and they're coming for you." And he also notices
And
that
they're
now a couple of.
inimical to life in the secondary realms.
And he also notices that an entire block of his neighborhood now looks like a giant, weird mishmash house of different styles, architects. It's going into the sky. It's got like brick, wood, stone. It's every different architectural style you can think of. And he's like, "That's weird." And his dad doesn't see anything, so he's like, "I think I'm going crazy." And basically, the Fetchers attack his school one day. Nobody else can really see them except for Arthur, and they come to his school and they're like trying to get him, but they have to be allowed into a room. That's one of the rules with the Fetchers. They have to be invited in, like Dracula, vampire rules.
Or Fey style, but not Akatar Fey, like actual Fey who have to tell the truth and aren't just hot elves with erogenous wings.
Okay, come on. Focus up, buddy.
And then eventually the fetchers he finds out are led by like this very beautiful man with a gold tongue and like wings, and we figure out that this is Monday's noon. And so one of the things we get explained later is that each of the trustees has a morning, a noon, and a night, Morning, noon, and midnight, I think.
Dusk.
Dusk. Yeah.
Dawn.
And so
it's dawn, noon, and dusk.
Dawn, noon, and dusk, which are basically like their lieutenants, and they're like the people who handle stuff. And so that he kind of like, there's a whole action scene in the library of the school where it starts burning down, and like salt is bad for the fetchers, so he kind of uses that. But then, how does he get to the house?
I have to mention this. One of the fetchers rips off his pocket. And then he gets rushed out. He has a panic attack and a fire starts in the school. And so he is taken to the hospital. And one of the things he learns while he's at the hospital is that there is a weird plague that is putting people to sleep. His friend Leaf, that he met on his first day of school, her family has been affected by it. She hasn't. And he opens up the atlas because this book keeps spitting out useful information. And he's like, yo, what's happening? What do I need to do? And the atlas is like, you need to go to the house and deal with it. And it shows
Fetchers
him.
are like minor nithling constructs. So they'll do like only a little bit of damage to the secondary realm, but that's what's happening. Anything from the house that goes to the secondary realms is like bad for it.
The book tells him where to go into the house. And I forgot why it justifies that he has to go there. Like, I don't remember. I think maybe Monday gives him a letter or something. Like, there's a thing that happens.
Yeah. To be honest, again, we started this like almost 2 months ago now.
Yeah,
so
it's been a while.
Remember. But he goes to the house.
And he meets the lieutenant keeper who keeps the front door of the house. He goes in. And he goes in at the lower reach, the what is it?
It's the lower house, the lower the, something of the house.
Because it's the something, the far reaches, the border sea,
yes, something maze.
Yeah, it's and but the first I'm forgetting
the incomparable
what the,
gardens. Yeah, I can't I remember know. Them, but yeah,
whatever the lower thing is, the lower portion of the house, and that's Mondays. That's Mondays. As you go up on house levels, you get more important, you get cooler stuff. But the lower part of the house, which is supposed to be the bureaucratic functioning part of the house, it's where messages are supposed to come through, bills come through, they get deeded to other places, and so it's basically a house of paper pushers, and it looks like streets of different like accounting houses. But, like, nobody's really working. There's paper everywhere, like, built up. And he ends up meeting someone named Susie Turquoise Blue, who thinks he is a Piper's child, which is what she is. And he's like, yo, you look human. And all these other people, because there's a bunch of squished people where they look like they were once tall, and now they're just squished.
So basically what happens is that those are the denizens. The denizens are the main people in the house. They're, like, the workers. They're kind of, like, angels essentially, and the better of them, like the noons and the look kind of like angels because they have
the
wings and stuff.
Superior denizens,
yes. And what happens is that there are like people shaped robots in that like they're really uncreative. They're not mortals. They're not able to really think about certain things differently. They're also extremely difficult to kill. Like you can cut off their head and their head will just survive on its own. They also like to have like illnesses like coughs as like, oh, that's a very distinguished thing to have. Like they almost trade it like a currency and stuff like that. And they're just so much fun because like, again, they really feel like almost human, but not really. Like they just can't think very well. When they get smarter, they actually get like taller and better looking. Like there's a very clear hierarchy in the house in that they're malleable in that way. And one of the things, and this is a little not off topic, but it's a good place to talk about it, is that one of the things that I really appreciated about Garth Nix a little bit as I got older and then as I was a child is that not so much in this one, but though it is in this one, but I noticed it the most in the Seventh Tower series and a little bit in Sabriel, is that he has a really egalitarian cast in terms of men and women, and that men and women will often have just the same jobs in the, so like the denizens are almost always about half female and half male in terms of named characters. And that was something that as a kid growing up, I think was really valuable because I remember being a little bit challenged by it originally. I remember thinking like, oh, that's a little weird. Like
that there were so many female pirates.
Like, and that kind of thing, it's just like, it kind of is like, you know, it's not the fantasy thing where it's like, oh, there's one tough chick among all the soldiers. Like, no, like half the soldiers are women. Like, that's a thing. And yeah, and that was very much the case. And I think that's actually, like, especially for that age group, really valuable. And also that the women were just very, like, non-sexualized in that, like, nobody in this book has any romantic anything with anyone.
Nothing.
And they're just characters doing their thing.
Nobody even looks at, because there are beautiful women who, like, who are described as very beautiful. And nobody is ever like, haba, haba. Like, it never happens. And it is so, like, because I remember as a young girl not noticing that. I actually noticed it way more as an adult, going, oh
interesting.
God, all the, like, that's so interesting. Because, like, in retrospect, I remember, like, a lot of the books I read when I was younger having primarily male, like, if there was a troop of soldiers or a gang of pirates, like, there might be one. And just in, not even in books, but in popular media, if you think of Pirates of the Caribbean, I think in the first movie, there is literally, besides old Elizabeth, one female pirate, and it was like Zoe Saldana before she did all her other stuff.
I was always annoyed she wasn't in the sequels. But yeah, and the thing is, as a boy, and okay, so at some point I will have to tell you guys my villain origin story with my mom making me read a bunch of feminist books when I was young. But even with her trying to do that, there is a kind of, like Maria said, you don't even notice. It's like Mistborn. Like, Sanderson didn't even, as an adult, realize he just wrote a book full of dudes until he had already done it. It's such the default that to have it not be the default challenged me a little bit. And I was like, oh, and I just remember thinking about that sometimes and being like, oh, I kind of wish I could write like that. Like, it feels so much more, I think it's valuable.
I think it's super valuable. And I think the reason in retrospect why as a young girl it didn't hit me is I was reading like a shit ton of Tamora Pierce. Like, I was reading a lot of, for young girls, like, or for like preteen, teenager girl books written by women that had like more female characters in it. But even then, some of Tamora Pierce's like books don't have as many like other female characters in it. And so it is. I think it's super valuable. And they're always like they're capable, and the mm-hmm. amount of less capable characters are also equally men and women characters. It's just, it's super interesting. And like, even in his family, his mother goes to work every day and his dad gets to play in his like recording studio and like is just living off royalties, you know? And so it's just, like, from the get-go, you definitely get this sense. Also, did you notice that it was in, like, a weird futuristic, but...
Yes. The world in it, and I remember being confused as this as a child, but, like, I've read some stuff since then. Yeah, it's, like, 10 minutes into the future is the trope name, and that, like, they have, like, nano machines every once in a while. He gets, like, a nano cast or something like
cast,
that at one point.
Or when Leaf... syncs to the TV and can change the channel with a motion. Like, there's a bunch of, because, like, for the most part, it just feels like, and weirdly, like, just, like, 1990s, like, early 2000s Britain, and then all of a sudden, people are syncing to TVs and changing the channel, or, like, you have a cast that'll fall off when your bone is healed because of the nanotechnology. And so it's really funny because it's so flawed, and it's also odd because the house and everything going on in the house is so crazy and absurd that you can easily miss these tiny details because you're just like, oh, we're back in our world. It ain't our world, honey.
Well, that's what's funny is that normally I would say like, oh, this is a mistake because you want the mundane world as a basis to then contrast the weird world with. But the thing is, I think because it takes so long to notice that by the time you do, you're just like, oh, that's kind of cool. Because like it confused me a little as a kid, but not a lot. And not until the later books did I really notice it.
On this read, I really didn't pick up on it until he broke his leg in Drowned Wednesday. And that's when you first start going, Is this world a little bit in the future? Like, it's mainly not, but is it? And people also
they seem
like,
to have already gone through coronavirus 10 years before it actually happened in real life.
It's crazy. It's so funny. Like their infectious disease prep was way better than what we had in 2020.
Yeah, to go back to the whole female characters thing. That's the thing about Susie Turquoise Blue, who's the character he just met. Who that is by far my favorite name in all of fiction and always has been. I just find there's something about it that just like rings really nicely, and she is like basically very Dickensian ragamuffin off the British streets.
Street urchin.
Like, hello, governor, that kind of likeness.
She
And
wears
like,
a squished hat, like a squished top.
and I loved it too because as a kid, especially, like, she's not the love interest. She's not like pretty or not pretty. She's just like, again, like this ragamuffin character who's a lot of fun, and she's like a very good ally to Arthur, but there's not like a romance or anything like that.
That scene in Thursday when she's hiding under the table, and the voice under the table keeps talking. Susie is a huge like reserve of comedy that just it's so great, and she's such a good contrast to Arthur's straight man slash audience surrogate.
Because she's one of the Pipers, she's one of the Piper's children. So she basically, what happens is the Pied Piper is a character in this world, and he stole a bunch of kids from the secondary realms and brought them to the house. And now they just kind of like have integrated into the system there, into the ecosystem, even though they don't really belong there. So they're all super old and like, but they keep getting washed between the ears, which means they get brainwashed, and their minds go
get
empty, which
wiped.
happens later and is like horrific for a children's book to read. It happens to Arthur at
Again,
one point.
if this was going to be filmed by a filmmaker who wanted to lean into it, that scene would be incredibly traumatizing. And so, but she still looks like a little girl. Like, she still looks like a young girl. All of them do. And they've also now become denizens in a sense where they are less fragile than actual humans. Like, one of the things that regularly gets mentioned about Arthur is he heckin' squishy.
Even for one of the Piper's children. Because what happens is that the more you interact with magic, the more stuck in the house you become, and your body becomes less human. And that's actually a big tension we'll talk about with Arthur going forward.
Susie thinks he's a Piper's child at first, but also she has the Will in her throat who's like, "Yo, Arthur, come help me. Like, let's do this." Or no, not yet. This isn't where he just meets Susie, and she's like, "What are you doing?" And he, they end up going. Susie has a hideout where she lives. She's an ink filler, in the lower. I guess it's just called the lower house. It's lower. Yeah, it's the lower house, the far reaches. Yeah, it's just the lower house. And it's in, like, she has to go up an elevator, and the elevators in this world are, like, they look like an elevator when you get into it, but when you see it from the outside, if you see someone going up in an elevator, it's just a beam of light shooting up into the sky. And it goes into this, like, they were in a building, but all of a sudden they're in an open glade that has a sealed off bubble, and outside it is these yellow and blue dinosaurs. And Arthur's like, are they gonna get in here? And the Will is basically like pops out of Susie's throat and is like, "Hi, I'm the Will, the architect. You're the heir to all the keys to the kingdom, and you need to get the other half of the first key from Mr. Monday and set the world to rights." And Arthur's like, "I, what? I can't. I'm little boy. What do you want from me?" And then they get attacked. The wall holding the dinosaurs back get attacked, and then Monday's dawn, noon, and dusk appear. And basically, Arthur gets captured. Susie pretends she doesn't know anything and fucks off with the Will for escape purposes. And they send Arthur into the coal cellar, which is a dark, dingy, terrible place in the house. And he originally was going to get sent somewhere worse, but then Monday's dusk was like, "Let's send him to the coal cellar, and then he if he stumbles upon the old one."
And the coal cellar looks like a coal cellar, but it's filled with like coal nothing. Basically, they're scraping together. Because again, everything in this world that isn't the house or the secondary realms is nothing, which is a substance that can kind of be, that again is almost acidic, like the alien blood in Alien. But like also, you can build things from. So they're scraping it together into these big, massive coal piles. And so Arthur kind of wanders through there, and then he does find the old one.
The old one. He also meets this guy named Pervuel, who, like, we're not gonna see again, but Pervuel's a baddie. Like, Pervuel pretends to help Arthur, and literally, like, Arthur knights him, and he's just an asshole, and he's gonna betray our poor boy. And he meets the old one, and the old one is basically the Prometheus character, where the architect's whole thing is she created the secondary realms, and she said to the people in the house, like, "Yo, my first children, don't fuck with the secondary realms. Just record what's happening in them. Record." She basically goes, "I made life. It's evolving in all of these different universes, because there's different worlds, there's different universes." Like, she made the multiverse. And she goes, "All you have to do, motherfuckers, is record what happens in the multiverses of the secondary realms." And one of the first people who fucks with the secondary realms is the old one, who was kind of her like partner god figure.
He is her. He is a part of her
Part
that
of her.
split. So,
Yes.
like, because again, it gets kind of a little existentially. And that's actually one of the things I really like about it is the way that, like, early on when he first met the frog, the Will or whatever, Arthur is like, "So where do people go when they die?" And the frog is like, "I don't know. Nowhere. Nobody goes anywhere as far as I know." And Arthur's like, he knew some religious stuff, but he hadn't really thought about it much. And like, I really like that because it makes it so that he's not constantly knowing references to the religious things, but you as the reader can kind of pick up on them. And so like, that's kind of a cool thing. So yeah, the old one is part of the architect who is God, but split, and he started messing around with the secondary realms, and she was
To
like,
help the creations.
right, and she was like, no good. And so she tied him. The implication is that originally this was a Prometheus situation, and now the way it looks, it's he's a giant tied to a clock on the floor with his hands chained to each of the arms. And so when the arms are the most spread out, he can't move, and that's when the cuckoo's children pop-up things come and take his eyes.
Out of the clock face. It's insane. And it the tension in that scene is so interesting because like there is this dread and buildup, but he basically talks to the old one, and the old one is like, "Oh, you want to fuck with the denizens of I hate the denizens of the house. I'm a help you." And he gives Arthur, like, Arthur has to ask him, he basically says, "You get to ask me three questions." And I love that at no point in this does Nix fall into the stupid, "Oh, that was one of your questions," trope.
In
Like,
the third book, when he has the same deal with the rats, Arthur's like, "Wait, if I ask a question," and they're like, no, it's just meaningful questions, we know.
yes, we know what a meaningful question is. We're not going to be dicks about it. And I love Nix for that. Because there are so many times where he stares a thing, like a in the face, and he's like, "Not today." Like, I love it. I love Nix for doing that. He regularly does that in his work, and it's fantastic. Just like he stared the, like, the kids are going to have to deal with the evil bad guys by themselves in the climax of the book in The Left-Handed Booksellers of London. And then he was like, "Nope, we're not doing
Yeah,
that."
he subverts the trope or averts it, and like
And
that's it's smart. And it doesn't treat kids like they're dumb.
It works really well. But anyway, so he has the conversation with the old one. He gets the information that he needs to kind of deal with this. And basically, it's, "How do I get out of here?" And the old one's like, "You're going to need to take the improbable stairs." And the improbable stairs are, they're
Plot
basically a
magic.
magical, yeah, plot magic. It's a crazy magic staircase that'll take you anywhere in the world that you're thinking of that you have to focus on, but it will also take you a ton of places in between, and you get off on landings, and then when you get off at one of the landings, you could be in like the dinosaur era. You could be in on a different planet. You could be in like the plague times of medieval Europe, you know? Like you just end up, and you have to find something that looks like a staircase or draw a staircase and then step back on it.
So basically, it's if we need to get somewhere, we have this, but it's dangerous, so we can't use it all the time plot element. But it actually kind of works because it is actually like treated as dangerous and like it won't work all the time. And so there's one part where the old one lets Arthur sleep and he's looking at the clock and he's like, "Will am I gonna let the little what are they called? I keep calling them."
Forgetting the term, but there's, you know, when you have
Yeah,
a
the little
clock,
Yeah,
they're the little. They're the little figurines, puppets
clock people.
almost. There's a clock people that pop out when the clock hits a certain thing, and you know, sometimes they dance. You have the cuckoo clock that literally goes cuckoo, but they're little wooden figurines that pop out of clocks and do shit. And in this case, it's take someone's eyes out.
And so the old one is thinking like, "Oh, should I have I reached the point where I will let them take out Arthur's eyes instead of mine for a night's rest?" And like, again, this is one of those things that's like weirdly dark, and like he doesn't, but then Arthur gets chased around by them.
He waits until the last minute to do it. Like, it's crazy. He like he waits because he stays enough for 2 12-hour cycles, and the first one he manages to escape, but the second one he ends up being too close and they chase him, and like they're getting other people. It's rough, and it's also dark, so we can't really see anything outside of the light of the clock for the old one. Preville helps him get out because he doesn't do the improbable stairs here. I forgot how he gets out of the coal cellar
Doesn't
because
he?
he
Him
does the
and.
improbable stairs with Susie.
I'm beyond. Again, I read this like 2 months ago. I cannot
She
remember.
might have, but I don't remember. Anyway, at some point he gets on the improbable stairs with Susie. At some point after this or during, he gets on the improbable stairs with Susie. They go through a bunch of locations. Susie also discovers her, like, she doesn't remember who she was before she came to the house, and she discovers her life, and she realizes that her family died of the bubonic plague, and that, like, she has nothing tying her back to the secondary realm, which helps her resign herself a little bit, like, to just living in this space.
It gives a really nice, like, moment of character to her. Like, this is the only moment of pathos for Susie in the series, but it's good that it happens early on because you're like, oh, she can't go home. And she's like, she feels very betrayed by it because the thing about it is that time between the house and the secondary worlds works really weird. And like, so the implication had always kind of been that like these Piper's children could go back to their homes at some point. And she realizes at this point, no, I can't ever really go home. I'm stuck here now. They took it from me.
And also, if she would have been there, like if she goes home, she'll die of the bubonic plague. So this is it. There's nothing to, because, oh, that was, she makes a deal with Arthur where she'll help Arthur if Arthur promises to bring her back to her, and you realize, no, that's never gonna happen. And so then Susie has to find her place in the house, and she does. And it works. You're right. Having it earlier definitely helps her as a
Endear you to
character,
her.
exactly. Throughout the whole thing. And they do the improbable staircase. They get to Monday's day room. This is also a really cool scene, and it's one that we don't get a lot of either. There are these weird creatures that will eat text, like anything that has writing on it. The bibliophages, they're these snake guys, and they'll eat anything that has text. And there's literally a point where Arthur has to take his watch off because a piece of his watch has words on it. He has to take his underwear off. He's literally in a long nightshirt with no pants, like just bits a dangling for his final showdown with Monday. And it's fucking hysterical because around the day room are these bibliophages, which was done on purpose so that the will could not come in and get close to Monday. So he goes in, he ends up having his showdown with Monday, and there's this thing that he has to say, to take the key from Monday and to claim it. And he gets the second half of the key. He puts it together. He defeats Monday. And Monday reverts back to a version of himself that was truer to who he was before the corruption. There is an idea that the breaking of the will and going against the will of the architect by the trustees has ruined them a little bit. And you don't know at this point if it is something that one of the later houses, the Morrow Days, has done to them to keep them as ineffectual servants, or if it's this is just the consequence of going against the architect's will.
Defying the will.
Exactly. And so when he's reverted, he looks different. He has a different demeanor. Sneezer, his butler, looks fantastic. Sneezer will never be, because like Sneezer is described so gross at the start of this book, and like the rest of the series, Sneezer is just the most properest gentleman, and I love him. And I also Monday's noon, or not noon, Monday's dusk had been helping Arthur. He had long since been like, yo, I don't like my boss anymore. He doesn't do anything, and everything's fallen into disarray. We're like 500 years behind on our paperwork. And this can't be what we should have done. I'm here for the architect. And so he helped Arthur. And so Arthur's like, you get to be my. He says to him, like, what do you want? Do you want to stay the noon? And he goes, I'd really like to spend some time during the day, because one of the things you learn is that the dusk, noon, and dawn can only go out during their hour. So if you're noon, you can only go out into the secondary realms from 12 to 1, and so on with the others. And he was like, I'd really like some lighter colored clothes. Like, I'm done with black. And so he swaps them around. Dawn gets to stay Dawn. And he basically goes, the will turns into kind of an old lady named Dame Primus. And she's like, you have to stay here and take. And so this will, who had been a deep-throated frog, becomes a woman. An old woman. And Arthur's like, I don't, I'd like to go back home. And they're all like, oh, that's fine, go home. Live a couple of years, but eventually come. Promise us you'll come back, and you'll. We'll no. Dame Primus is like, I'll come for you. and we'll deal with this. And, you know, go live your life. Because Arthur's like, I don't want to stay here. I don't want to take care of the house. I don't want to go this thing. I want to be a real boy.
Dame Premise is like, this is a waste of time, but okay, whatever.
Yes, whatever. And she's like, but you have to, he's like, can I don't want to have the key. Like, what do I do? And she's like, well, you can pass it on to someone. And he's like, okay, I pick you. And she's like, this is most irregular. You can't just give it. And then she's like, well, technically you can't. So he gives it to Dame Primus. And then he goes back to his world and he gets home late on Monday. And he's like, phew, what a world. And he goes to sleep. And then it's Tuesday. And then shit starts going down. And so the way this book works is by the time he gets home, it's the end of the day or it's the next day, which means there's a new realm of denizens that he has to deal with. So this boy has had no fucking breaks. And fucking exhausting. I feel for my boy Arthur so much. Grim Tuesday yeah. opens with him getting a phone call from Dame Primus being like, Arthur, it's chaos here. We need you to come back. And he's like, I've been gone for a couple hours. She's like, it's been 6 months here. And basically she's like, Grim Tuesday has collected his deaths. And also one of the Morrow Days comes to Tuesday and is like, yo, I want you to help me fuck with the new guy that took over Monday. And he's like, we are not supposed to interfere. And they were like, well, yeah, you're right. We're not supposed to interfere with the other days, but you have the ability to call the debts. Because what Mr. Monday had been doing was having Tuesday. So Grim Tuesday, it's he creates stuff. Anything in the house that you need, weapons, buildings, cool shit, Grim Tuesday creates from nothing. And he lives on top of basically nothing mine. A precarious, ready to fall apart nothing mine. And he had
I'm sure
been
that won't become relevant.
At no point will that become relevant later. And he had been making stuff for Monday. And like, it's just assumed that eventually he would pay. But they knew, like, he was just behind.
Monday is America and Tuesday was China. And it was like, okay, but, like, you should be paying, but you're not going to. And it's fine. And then Tuesday was like, all right, okay, if you say so, if Saturday is backing me on this, all right, you guys all need to bring in your debts.
And also, because if he calls in his debts and they don't have enough liquid money, which they should have, they should get paid for their services, but they not only have they not been paying anyone, they have not been requesting payment for any of their services. So they have no money. And so he can take the key and take over the lower house as part of the payment. And so she's like, you need to come back. We got to deal with this. And he's like, no, I don't want to do that. That sounds like a terrible idea. She's like, by the way, he's going to come for your family. And basically Grim Tuesday sends out his,
Yes. Cause this is so cool. Basically, usually again, you have a morning, a noon and a dusk. And he was like, that's not good enough. So he pushed them all together to make one thing and then took them out into seven different grotesques. Like, I always thought of them as like the seven dwarves from Snow White. And like, and so he sends two of them after him, which is so cool because they don't like being seventh of a per. I don't know how that integer
three
would work,
sevenths. But they don't like being three different set. They don't like being a seventh of three different people, but you're also not a huge amount of any of the three. But anyway, so he sends them to Arthur's world to invent debts, because one of the secondary the house can fuck with the secondary realms in ways that make it feel legitimate. And so all of a sudden they're like, you owe us money, give us all your money. And Arthur's like, but my family has money. And like, they're literally like, a mall is going to get built in this neighborhood, and they're repossessing the whole area. His mother's hospital is going down. His sister's school is out of funding. She no longer is she's been kicked out of university because there ain't no money. His dad's record label is like, you have to come back and make more songs. And he's like, oh shit, my family's livelihood is going to go to hell. I have to deal with this. So he has to go back into the house, and he ends up going in to the far reaches, which is Grim Tuesday zone. He gets taken in a chain gang. Tuesday has
every time in the series, basically what happens is the book starts, he somehow loses power over one of the keys that he had in the previous day, and then he has to go undercover into the realm of the new place. And that basically happens every single time. And it's a good structure. I'm not complaining. It's just funny. And in this case, yeah, now he's going to have to be part of the chain gang. But like, they're like, But he's one of the Piper. He's a child in the Denizens, and so the Denizens don't need to like rest or do stuff, and so he can't really keep up.
And it's rough because also now that he doesn't have one of the keys, even though the key helped his asthma. So in the first book, anytime he has the key or when he's in the house, it helps with his asthma. And in the Far Reaches, he doesn't have that, but he just gets tired. He's just so tired. And he has some residual magic from using the key so much in the first book that he has some residual magic he's able to use. But he basically gets they think he's an indentured servant who's been paid into Grim Tuesday service. Susie ends up finding him. They get these wings that can only fly up. They go up to the top of the mine thing, and they have to get into. They're like, where on earth would Grim Tuesday have hidden his section of the well? And it's like he has a giant treasure palace where he keeps all of his treasure. And they're like, it's probably in there. So they go in. They get helped by. So Grim Tuesday one day had beef with his eyebrows, and he just ripped them off. He ripped them off and he threw them off. And one of his eyebrows landed in a pool of nothing, and some of the nothing affected infected it, and he became half eyebrow, half nithling. Nithlings are when nothing of its own accord coalesces into a terrible creature. So the fetchers are manufactured nithlings, but there are also like nithlings, like if enough nothing combines together, it becomes gobbets that fly from the sky, and if enough gobbets combine together, they can become a nithling.
Because remember, from nothing came something, and something from nothing. And that's okay. So I have complained many times now, most notably in Mistborn and then in Divine Rivals, that if you're going to write shit, write cool shit. Give us cool shit. And this stuff is so cool.
So
And I
cool.
love how he takes a simple idea and kind of really builds on it in a logical way. And so, like, there are more advanced Nithlin constructs at later points. We're going to meet someone who actually is able to.
Oh, the slicer guy.
Yeah, I don't know where that
We
happened,
completely.
but.
Oh, it happens at the beginning before he even gets into the house. And there's that whole thing where Susie has to throw her dad's medals at the Leaf's medals at the. Anyway, it's a scene you don't have to worry about. It doesn't affect the plot too much. Just don't worry about it, you guys. But Will and I appreciated it. It was a cool scene.
But this one's funny because they have wings, right, that they can't really control. The wings will just, you put them on your back and they'll put you
And you can do
upward.
direction, but it's only gonna go up.
But the problem is that this was Susie's plan, but she realizes that actually, like, maybe they can't hang on by their arms going like this across an entire roof. So instead, they have to keep the wings on and brace themselves when they're going to hit the roof. But this creates a thing where they keep stumbling and falling and getting mouthfuls of ash as they keep getting hit against the roof. And it's just a really funny scene. And that's the thing, is Garth Nix somehow keeps coming up with like fun, cool action scenes, and they're like genuinely interesting and exciting to read.
They really are, especially because this book series has a formula to it, and you easily could, in the hands of a less talented writer, become very, very bored and tired of it. But Will is completely right. He just creates such interesting, unique, and engaging scenes, because this is a fantastic scene. They basically have to use, like, as they get pushed back down, they have to shuffle across the ceiling of this place to try get to the because they also have stick-on glovey things that eventually they're gonna have to get to the pyramid that houses the treasure trove, get the wings off, stick on to the glass, and then like stick them their way to a door
and get going.
and get going.
Yeah.
And while they're struggling in this, there's a fucking slug eyebrow with suckers on the bottom going and being like, hello.
This is where also the narrator, like, I remember liking this as a kid, but the narrator really gives some of the best, again, outside of Sergeant Tuukka's Blue, who I'm annoyed by, but like some of the voices he gives to the secondary characters are so much fun because it just sounds like a weirdly serious slug eyebrow. Like he, like, you get a
It is.
sense of importance from him.
It's crazy, and it's got a little bit of Grim Tuesday's actual voice to it, but much less angry and like it's so interesting how he does it, because he really brings a lot of richness and color to the world through his narration. So this is I would recommend
The
and
audiobook.
I will say that one of the things, especially with the audiobook, that's harder to get in, it was easier reading it than it was listening to it when I first started, is there is a level of absurdity, as I mentioned before, to this as a concept, and the narration has a little bit of a. It's not taking itself too seriously, and it has some, like, times where it jumps into things quickly because it doesn't need to give you all the reasoning. It doesn't need, like, it's not trying to make this the most realistic world that has ever existed. And so as a reader, especially if you are used to reading not this, it's a little bit hard to get into the tone, and you notice that there is a certain sense of juvenileness to the narration initially, but like in the way where like somebody reading a bedtime story, that's actually the tone. The narrator just sounds like he's retelling you, like he's reading you a children's book that happens to be really fucking intense.
It has that Britishness of like old British YA of like, oh, I'm telling a child a story as an adult on a chair. Not
Yes.
the I am a 30-year-old woman writing porn. I'll
I
never
know,
forgive
I know.
Avatar. One thing this book did remind me of, and I should have mentioned this back during the video game part, but I didn't. But people of my generation will know, it reminded me a lot of Kingdom Hearts, where you're going to these different secondary realms, which are the Disney realms in Kingdom Hearts, and then you have the main central realm, and it's like kind of absurdist at the same time, and you have the Heartless versus the Nothings, and then like I that always kind of reminded me of that.
I haven't played that game, but I've seen enough AMVs and stuff like that, and I know enough about it to be like it definitely has Kingdom Heart vibes. Yeah, so they get into the treasure tower, they end up finding a room, the atlas of the house, and basically the atlas is the architect's notebook that she wrote, and it just has all any information you could need about the house or the secondary realms the atlas can tell you. But it only works when you have a key or you have enough magic in you from a key, which Arthur is actively trying not to have. Not yet. He
Which
doesn't know
will,
it yet.
yeah, I was gonna say that's the thing that comes up in Thursday that I really liked. They find a room with this really big dude sitting in it, and we find, and this is the Mariner. He is one of the three children of the Old One and the Architect. The three children are the Mariner, the Pied Piper, and then Lord Sunday. And he has basically been indentured to Grim Tuesday for some reason I can't remember. And he is he has. Like the coolest, which is this big anchor he uses as a weapon, or a harpoon he uses as a weapon. And there's a part where he uses it, and the way Garth Nix describes it is just so cool. Like there's a ringing reverberation off it that can like shred skin from bone. And like that's one of the things Garth Nix is really good at doing, is like just coming up with these cool weapons, like condensed midnight. At one point, he talks about some of their weapons, or like ore hardened in the heart of a sun, and like he comes up with like these really cool celestial ideas behind like the tech at times.
And it really is the way that the use of the harpoon, and he calls it his friend. Like that's he there's no name for the harpoon, but it's just his friend. And it appears and disappears out of his hand. So when he needs to use it, it's there. But when he doesn't, it's not there. And it's glowing, it's white, and when you use it, it creates light. But it also like it makes your teeth and your bones hurt if you're too close to it. And if you're too close, like Will said, your skin's getting shredded off, my guy. And it's fantastic. And they're in a room of tiny little bottles, or like bottles with ships in it. And basically, the Mariner is like, "Oh, you're Mr. Monday, so I can." Nobody's ever told me not to. Tuesday's never told me not to talk to you. And I technically, because you're one of the trustees, should listen to you unless Tuesday has specifically told me not to. And he's like, "I can't answer. I can't tell you things, but if you asked questions, I might be able to." And basically, they find out that the will is hidden. All of these little bottles with ships are in little pocket worlds, and you can, if the there's one ship that's a little spaceship that's facing a sun that they can see in the bottle. And basically, Grim Tuesday hid his piece of the will in the heart of a sun that you get through this heart traversing ship, heart sun traversing ship.
It's a planet, lost, not planet, stolen planet. What's that one that the Cyborg Tinkerer one we were like, it's the same tech? I haven't watched it. Treasure Planet? It's like Treasure Planet is how I thought of it
I
in
see.
terms of like a starship.
For me though, because it's described just like a shell, like a turtle, it looks like it kind of just looks like a turtle. It feels more just like just sci-fi. Like you.
You're right. I may have not thought that through. We'll cut that part. Yeah, no, I knew I pictured it correctly as well. I wasn't not paying attention for a minute. And so they go into this miniature world to get the part of that part of the will. And what's cool about this is that this is a fetch quest. It's a fetch quest.
It's
And
just a
it
fetch quest.
works. For some reason, it doesn't destroy the tension. It's still actually kind of fun and interesting, and I'm not totally sure why this works, whereas other fetch quests and books we've read haven't worked.
I think part of it is the Mariner is so great. And I think he helps, like his charisma and everything helps, but it shouldn't, because there aren't a lot of fetch quests in the rest of the book. Like the getting the will and stuff from in Wednesday isn't a fetch quest, because that's it. That's the entire goal of that book. And it's the climax of it, so it doesn't feel like a fetch quest, where this definitely feels like a fucking fetch quest. And you're right, I can't, I think I'd have to like look at it again within the context of the book. You know what part of it is? Tuesday as a book is less fun in the before. There's not as much fun, like there is some fun stuff, but it's a little,
Dark.
it's
Yeah,
dark,
and
and
this
then
is
this has
fun.
like
We're like pirates for a minute, and we go and we figure out all the stuff with the will. That's hilarious. And that we'll talk about in a minute.
the boots, and there's like they go, and it's like a beach, like a tropical beach world inside this sun, and also he brings stakes into it, where they go, they find the whale, and then as they're taking them back, there are these weird like creatures that are like spirits. They're not spirits, they're like very hot.
They're like elemental, like celestial things. That again, very cool. I think also because we are in this for the world building, and the world building doesn't stop being cool during this moment. He's still very good at writing action, so the action is fun. And also, like, there is the characters are kind of just along for the ride a lot of the times. Again, the emotional stakes are somewhat distant, and so it doesn't really matter that nothing is happening during this point. Like, the point of this, that we came to this book to read about cool shit happening, and so cool shit is happening, and so we're like, okay, that's fine.
What I think the problem is, I think if this book took itself too seriously, and we were here for more of the like character development, emotional stakes, I think this would feel like a break in that tension and the buildup of something greater. But because the book isn't doing that, and it's not like that's not the goal of it, it works better. Because you're right, it is just like an action book, and
It's
so the
fun.
action, it's a fun scene. And I guess the other thing is, it's just not boring. There's high t stakes. There's a point where they have to get in the ship, and the ship's like gonna fall apart, and they have to like get in, like there's a like
We think we know what's going on with the will, but we get here and this will is very different from the first
very
will in that
different.
it doesn't believe Arthur that he's
The
what's
air.
the heir. He's like a golden bear. But the bear's like, I don't believe you. And then they're like, okay, but you're gonna get destroyed if you stay here. And he's like, fine.
And he won't make any decisions. Like, he won't commit to doing something.
This is actually another good point to mention it. To talk about the disability rep. Because what happens
Yes.
is, we've mentioned it, but basically, when he's in this house or when he's holding the key, he doesn't have asthma problems. His body actually functions, can just heal and stuff. And so, one of the books we just read was Fourth Wing and its sequel, Iron Flame, whose disability rep is probably the worst we've read in this channel so far, in terms of the ways that it tells, it has the toxic perseverance trope of like, if you're disabled, it's okay, but you just have to work harder and that'll be better. And in this one, like, that doesn't work. There's one part where Arthur pushes himself in the secondary realm, and like, he realizes that was a mistake. I should not have done that. And like, he almost collapses, I think, at one point. And so, and it's not also something, it doesn't fall into the trope of like, disability, but oh, I have a magic thing that takes it away and fixes it. It doesn't fix it. It's an aid for a little bit, but at the same time, it's balanced with the, I will become less of myself the more magic comes in, and part of myself is that asthma.
And that's exactly what I was going to mention, because there's a point where he realizes, no, he wants his humanity, and that means also being like, nah, I take it with the asthma, with everything. I want to live and have a normal life, and my normal life is with my asthma. And because there's a point in the first book where he's really pleased that when he's holding the key, when he's in the house, he doesn't have his asthma. And there's a point where the leftover magic makes his one lung a bit stronger, so even in the second his own world, he's a bit stronger. And then for him to try make the choice to not have that is fantastic. And also, it's not that the magic of the house specifically just fixes his asthma. He doesn't need to eat, he doesn't need to drink, he technically doesn't need to sleep. And so it's dealing with just a lot of human bodily functions, and that's why the asthma part is dealt with. So it's not just like in some books where like it like there is just a magic to fix that thing.
Yeah, it's imagine being able to tell themes and character and story through disability instead of just having it as a thing where your boyfriend builds you a saddle and then you forget about the fact that your joints can break easily when you want to have rough sex. I will never forgive Fourth Wing. And the thing about it also is the other thing I liked about it, how he treats his disabilities. He's never like, oh, woe is onto me. I am Batman. I have been crippled. It reminded me a lot of Godkiller, where like she doesn't have a leg and she just kind of deals with that on a daily basis. There's a practicality to it of like, oh, this is just how things are that they deal with. And I really like that. I think that's a good way of handling it.
And the things he has to keep in mind, like if I'm going to do stuff, I have to make sure that if I'm being more active, keeping a pace. Like there's a practicality to how he has to think about what he needs to do and all of that jazz that I think really works. I'm sure some people might look at this and go, but when he's in the house, he doesn't have it, so bad rep.
It's not fixed. That's the thing. If it was like he got the key and then after that point it was fixed, yeah, okay, that's that trope. But I think because it's a thing he keeps having to juggle is what makes it work.
And because he wants to be human, and that means choosing to be human with his asthma over getting to be a denizen with none of these issues, I think that also makes it work because he's choosing to live the life. And like I said, I don't remember. I don't think I've finished the series, so I don't know if that's the choice that he gets to make. So he challenges Grim Tuesday. He gets the and basically, there's this point where like he's like, "It's me. I'm the thing." And the Will's like, "No, I will not allow you to take the key until I know if you are." And so he makes them do a competition where they have to create something. And one of the things that Will mentioned is denizens are not creative. They cannot create something themselves. All Grimm's Tuesday does is he copies shit that other people have created from the secondary realms. He either takes them or he creates his own versions or both.
He is like China. Interesting. I didn't see that parallel before.
God damn it. Like, stop. Stop it.
So he builds this like super beautiful construct thing. I forget what it is. It's like a statue of something.
But he copied it from the secondary realms. And then Arthur creates a xylophone thing, and then he does a song that he wrote himself, and they were like, the Mariners, the judge, and he's like, "Authors with true creativity, congratulations, boy." And they're like, "Woohoo!" And then Grim Tuesday is like, "No." The other thing that is happening is the caverns of the far reaches are falling in on themselves, and the nothing is about to explode. And Arthur has to go down. Is the first thing he has to do with the second key is go down and fix it.
The thing about it, the xylophone thing, is even as a kid, I remember thinking, like, that's not a culmination of the themes of the book up until this point. Like, it is a little tacked on in terms of, like, oh, building things, being able to come up with new things, even if they're not as good, is better than just copying. Like, that's just a thing he says at the end of the book, essentially. And that's one of the ways that the books aren't necessarily a lot deeper than what's on the surface, and they could be. There's no reason they can't be, but it's just not a thing I think Nix was interested in doing.
And I do think doing that could have been a bit, would have made it better. And I think kids are capable of enjoying and engaging with that kind of stuff. But it is what it is. And but he goes down to fix the thing, and he's one of Grim Tuesday's grotesques are down there, and basically it's like, "Oh, you're my master now. We have to fix this." And it's basically like a wall that was built holding back the tides of nothing, and he has to fix it. And he's trying to fix it, and the grotesque is like, "Hey, when we're done here, would you mind putting us back together into our three separate people? We don't like living like this." And this is one of the rare moments where the narrative slows down for a minute and looks the terrible things. Because again, there's a lot of shit that you're like, that's terrifying. Like, that's terrible. But the narrative is like, doo, 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 and just at such a speed. And for this brief moment, it slows down and looks you in the face and goes, "Help, I don't like this." And you're like, "Oh no, that's terrible." And then Saturday's noon?
Yeah, Saturday's noon is constantly snooping around doing shit, and it kills them.
It kills the grotesque and then stabs our boy Arthur, and then you're like, "What the fuck?" But Arthur ends up like fixing it. He fixes the wall, blah blah blah, and then he goes up in an elevator, and then staring by the side of nothing is a red skeleton. Looking at child size, Arthur sized red skeleton, watched this whole thing happen, and then just fucks off. And you're like, What the fuck? Who is this? What is this thing? And there's the idea that, and it calls itself the skinless child. No, I don't like this. And then the book ends, and then the next book starts, and there's nothing. You don't hear anything about it.
At the end of Tuesday, then Arthur's like, okay, fine. I have to be I can't just go back to my world and live my normal life. I'm gonna have to fix this problem. But I want to go back to say bye to everybody and make sure my family's okay and stuff. And they're like, okay, cool. Even though Dane Primus, who now has absorbed the Sun Bear and now talks a little different, is like, you really should give away your humanity and come be the stop shirking your responsibility. And he's like, all right, just take the key for now and I'll come back. And that's how Wednesday starts.
Yeah, and he's in the hospital. He's got a broken leg and
Drowned Wednesday.
drowned Wednesday. This is a good, and you see him in the hospital bed. And again, this is one of the fun things that happens. He's in the hospital. His friend Leaf comes by and is like, "Yo, buddy, what happened? That Scoucher thing?" Because there's a whole thing that happened at the beginning of Groom Tuesday with Leaf, and she's like, "The fuck?" Also, Leaf saw him and Susie on the Improbable Stairs at one point in the first book, and she's like, "Motherfucker, I'm going insane. Explain." And so he explains what's happening, and she's
She
like,
has weird sight because she's
"Yeah,"
Irish.
and she's like, "Oh, I want to have an adventure," and he's like, "No, you don't. They fucking sucks, Leaf." And she's like, "No." And then he gets a letter for that is like, "You are cordially invited to a lunch to lunch, with Drowned Lady Wednesday. Transportation not required. You will be picked up. No RSVP required." And he's sitting there with like Leaf and talking about all this stuff. And then like water just starts flooding the room. And the other thing that I should mention is the book opens with a description of the seas and how that it's the border sea is Wednesday's realm.
This is like one of the coolest.
It is surrounds different parts of the house, and it's how you can sail from parts of the house to the secondary realms. And so she had like some guys who worked on the like she had some actual ships and sailors, but then when everything went down, when the architect disappeared, a little bit after that, this border sea exploded, went past its borders, and like old like accounting houses and stuff had to get turned very quickly into ships because the border sea just exploded. Parts that were originally like land are just so far beneath the ocean now. And Drowned Wednesday turned into a Leviathan and has eaten a lot of her people. And this is a terrifying backdrop. When I tell you, Drowned Wednesday is what fantastic.
It's great. And the thing
It's
about
so
it
good.
is that it's also a nice shakeup of the formula of the series. I had just said a minute ago that the formula is that like Arthur loses the keys for whatever reason, has to go undercover and defeat the trustee of that house or that day. And in this case, Wednesday herself does not want to be the trustee anymore. She wants to give the key away. But what happened is she was talking to Saturday about it. They were gal paling or whatever, and then Saturday betrayed her and took away her key. And without her key, all of a sudden her gluttony
Oh.
just went out of control, and that's how she became this massive leviathan that just eats
And
everything.
that was, it's actually interesting because I have a theory about why that happened to her, is I think she was poisoned with nothing to start. And that's why she had to
Oh.
eat so much to get, and that's why, because she started becoming, and that when she had the key, it was holding it at bay. But then when she lost the key, she had to get giant so that the amount of nothing poisoning inside her, because like there's a point where he like, "Congratulations, you're not a giant whale anymore," but she eats so much. Like, she just keeps eating, and I feel like she's eating so that the nothing is eating what she's eating instead of eating her.
That's smart, yeah.
That because she had these, because she immediately starts just eating a ton, and then that's when she's like, "Hey, I think we fucked up, guys." Because again, you're not sure, is this a result of her betraying the architect or because of something the Morrow Days are doing? She goes to Superior Saturday and says, "Hey, this isn't good. I want to give it up." And that's when they take the key from her, and then she blows up into the giant whale.
And she ate her noon and dusk, which is so funny.
And tons of denizens, anything. She literally, and she's not just like, "Oh, a giant whale." She is 150 feet long. She is 50 something wide. She is an island. She is a landmass. She is gargantuan on a scale that is hard to comprehend while you are reading this fucking book. It is terrifying. And that's why she's called Drowned Wednesday, because now she's just a giant whale in the ocean, just feeding and
everything.
constantly eating. It is terrifying. Our boy Arthur gets swept into the border sea with Leaf because she didn't listen when he told him to get out of the fucking hospital room.
The ship that Drone Wednesday had sent to get Arthur instead picks up Leaf. And they're like, you're not Arthur. And then Arthur gets stuck by a buoy, and then he gets picked up by some pirates. These pirates are not pirates, but they're like shipmen. They're kind of
reclaimers. They're salvagers. That's what they call
basically
themselves.
One of them was a ship person, and then the rest of them were accountants who are now sailors. And like, they're so bad at being pirates, it's hilarious. And the other thing is that like, they still get tea service at 12 every day. Somewhere in the house, someone is sending them tea. So no matter what they're doing, they have to stop and have tea. And it's
for
just
15
it's,
minutes.
It's such a great, it's so funny seeing the denizens who again are just very inflexible. They're not humans. They can't really change in that British way, almost just being like, oh, it's tea time. It's important. We have to do this. And the one guy who was a sailor was like, oh God, this again,
yeah, it's fucking,
like, we can't stop it.
And he's had to resign himself to the fact that like, that's just going to happen every day. I really like the crew. You also meet Dr. Scamandros, and he is a sorcerer who had been trained in the upper house. There's a whole thing with the border sea that anything is lost ends up in the border sea at some point. Dr. Scamandros is here looking for his final term paper that got mysteriously missing, but he's never going to find it. It got stolen. And
he has like living tattoos that will form different shapes based off of what he's thinking, which is like really
his
cool.
emotions. Arthur's a little skeptical of him at first, but then they kind of become friends. There's this his friend Leaf ends up becoming a ship's boy on that one ship that took her. There are these drowned rats that are just giant rat guys who are very like, they got Napoleon hats, you know, the whole nine yards. They're looking good.
They're not scathing guys.
They get
she doesn't know the Warhammer reference. She's an uncultured barbarian. Go ahead.
I am. They get hired to find things, and they deal in information, and they're a really cool mechanic, and they're also something that the Piper, so on top of, you know, the Piper with the rats and the children, like, that guy, he did the same thing. These are the rats. And Susie hired them to try find Arthur, and there is, on top of all of this that Bowie Will mentioned, was also this terrible pirate named Sunscorch? Feverfew, yeah, Sunscorch is the good guy on the ship.
And Feverfew is such a terrifying pirate. He's like a sorcerer. He has like nothing weapons.
He used to be human, and now he's so changed. He's like, he's like a black.
His face was eaten by
form.
Nothing, wasn't it?
He's literally almost just like a black raisin of a human, but he overlays what he wants to look like. And there's this point where Arthur is seeing like the debonair, black mustached, tan pirate, and then also seeing the like eaten, warped, was once a human. Like this is what too much magic and too much house stuff will do to just a human. With no interference from the house to, like, make it better for you. Feverfew wants Arthur because Arthur stole something. Arthur didn't. Arthur found a buoy that marked one of Feverfew's treasure troves. And then the ship that came to get him, the Moth, was like, you found it. You have the red hands that marks you as a Feverfew bandit. But we're just going to steal this anyway.
The thing is, the first half of this book is like one long action sequence. And like, this was a point where I was like, oh, wow, he's really good at writing this. Like, I'm not getting bored. Like, I'm still interested in this. And so, yeah, basically they end up getting away. Oh, Wednesday's Noon, who's like the only one left, comes to get him. And she's like haughty and bitchy.
Dawn. Wednesday's Dawn.
My favorite character. And she can also turn into like a porpoise, I think.
A shark. It's a golden shark. My guy.
I never remember. Anyway, she takes Arthur to see Wednesday. And what Wednesday has done is she has slowly shrunk herself into a person. And when she meets Arthur, Arthur's like, oh no, this is going to be a fight. But this is where she tells him that no, she wants to give up the thing. But she's like, I can't stop eating. So she's literally eating a course of food as they're talking. And then as she gets to the end, she's like, you need to go before I expand back into my little elephant form.
Because he talks to Dawn as he's getting there. And he's like, what do we do when she changes back? And Dawn's like, we f- fucking run, my guy. And they're on a ship by themselves. They literally sailed a ship to a location. Everybody else fucked off. He's meeting her there. She's half formed. Like, she's humanoid shaped, but she's kind of like mushy and half formed. And like Will said, she's just, it is such an intense scene. And she's telling this story of like how all of a sudden she just had this appetite and it increased in slow increments, and then all of a sudden it was so bad that she started having to use the key to keep herself the size she wanted to be. And then when Saturday betrayed her and she blew up, and there's literally, and as she's talking to him, she's getting bigger as she's eating because she's losing the ability. She also has the third key put in her thing, and she's like, listen, you need to find the will. You need to break Feverfew, because Feverfew has also cursed her as well on top of this. Grim Tuesday was obviously helping out with this, and Feverfew was also brought in on this of fucking up Wednesday. And she was like, you need to find the will, and then you need to come and get the key, and you need to set me free. Like, I'm done living this life. And he's like, you got it. No problem. I got you.
This is very cool. And I really like Wednesday, and I really like all of this. But it is kind of fat phobic that, like, because literally at one point she's like, I know you're disgusted by me. I'm disgusted by me too. And like, I think it's okay, the idea that she literally needs to eat a ton. I think just the imagery of this extremely fat woman being scary, maybe could have been, we could have done something different with that.
And I agree. And that's why I liked the idea of her being just a Leviathan more, because it just feels like a, not a human grotesque appetite. It just felt like a curse hunger. Kind of thing, a hunger thing, and also just like a giant whale. And so I like that a bit more. But yeah, I will say, especially the scene where she is eating is rough in that sense. And I would completely agree.
But this was also like 15, 20 years ago at this point. So it's like, yeah, he probably didn't know any better at the time. And again, I think it is a horrific scene. Again, it's very Studio Ghibli in like the sense of like that old woman with the head, I forget which episode it is in Sesame Street, but the one with the woman with the very hooked nose who's large. Oh, no, it's the one the black thing is eating across the hall, and Big Bird has to run from it.
I'm not engaging with you, William. You can walk yourself out of that door.
But no, the book does a very good job of building her up as like this horrific thing that's scary.
You know, it's the first time we've had a trustee who's like, nah, this is fucked. I tried to stop this ages ago and look what's happened to me. So he ends up kind of going to to this one area where a bunch of ships, because he wants to find his friend Leaf, and she's at this one place where a bunch of ships have kind of like all been lashed together. Leaf isn't there anymore. Her ship was attacked by the pirate Feverfew, so she's been taken. And he ends up going to the drowned rats. They're helping him. He has to answer some of their questions. They answer some of his, and he basically hires them because he needs to find... Wednesday has told him that she thinks the will is being hidden on Feverfew's secret island that he's got somewhere, his hideout. And the rats are like, oh, yeah, we think that's in Wednesday. Like, we think it's in her stomach. We sent a rat in once and we got back a lot of good data. We've never been ourselves, so we can't say for certain. But that's what our sources tell us. And he ends up getting Dr. Scamandros to help him. He's been injured. And then the moth, the pirate crew, or not the pirate, the scavenger crew we befriended earlier, has also been taken by Feverfew. And they've all become slaves to work doing salvage in Drowned Wednesday's stomach. And so Arthur's like, I have to save them, but also he doesn't have enough time, because basically the plan is to take a submersible into Drowned Wednesday, get into the little worldlet inside her from the door. There's a water door that you can get up in there, get the will, get out, and then eventually come back and deal with Feverfew and free all the slaves, because there's just not enough time. They end up doing the thing, they go in. Susie, by this point, has joined the party and is helping Arthur. And they go in. They have to disguise themselves as rats. And there's a point where, like...
Oh, yeah. They start thinking they're rats.
Yeah, they almost forget that they're humans. Like, Scamandros did a really good spell. It was almost too good.
By the way, did you think Scamandros' voice was weird? I did not think he had, like, an accent when I read the book originally.
No, I didn't. Especially, like, a weird, like...
Ethnic-y accent? Yeah.
It was really weird, because I didn't think that at all. But anyway, it's fine. Sometimes you realize this thing that audiobook narrators have a weird power where, depending on what voice they give the character, it can really color your experience. Like, I, as a when I was younger, thought of Dr. Scamandros as much more, I don't want to say intimidating, but he's in my head, he felt a little bit more capable, and the voice that he gives him makes him feel very not
Like a
capable.
little goofy and like eccentric uncle. Yeah, that's so funny. That's true. That's me too.
They go in, they end up getting to, because one of the things the rats also heard is that there are these hills, and in the hills there are escaped slaves who worship the carp. And people are like, what the fuck's a carp? And our boy Arthur is like, I know some animal, I knew some creatures that had really good talking skills that could maybe create a cult. And so they find the followers of the carp. And this is also, this world that is in a secondary realm. So Arthur has to deal with his asthma here. And like his, he can't run too quickly. He has to keep a steady pace. He has to be mindful of that. They find the followers of the carp, who bring them to a goldfish in a giant bowl, who's like, Arthur! Well, and basically this carp has been telling people for like the past 500 years, like, one day the heir to the house shall come and destroy Thievapew, and we shall all be free. And they're like, the heir to the house has come. It had been foretold. Faith in the carp. The carp really created a cult up here on this
It's
island.
very Life of Brian, if you've ever watched that movie, where it's like it feels like it's poking fun at religion a little bit, which it's weird the book doesn't do more, considering, again, it's heaven with British people.
Again, I don't like heaven because
What? The celestial heaven god house?
they end up having to take the carp, and they're like, okay, we're just gonna get back to the thing, but they end up getting captured by Feverfew. Arthur and him have to have like a battle. He ends up.
There's this whole thing about like having to cut off his head, and then he's like, okay, but if I cut it off, I have to cut it off this way because I was told this is a trick he
Yeah,
does.
I have to put the blade on the stump of his neck so the head can't reattach. But Feverfew is tricksy.
Yeah, and Feverfew fixes it, which again is like kind of a nice little like subversion of the expectation. There's the whole Gawain and the Green Axe thing happening, and then he tries to subvert it, and then Feverfew subverts it on him. Again, Feverfew is actually like a very cool villain. The books are actually very good at building kind of horror in their villains in a way that just a lot of other books aren't. And again, this is not a like a super emotionally well mapped out book. Yeah, charged book.
They end up killing Feverfew by throwing him into a boiling pot of nothing, like a geyser of nothing. But when they kill Feverfew, the magic holding this worldlet together is falling apart into nothing. Like, it is literally just fading into the nothing expanse. And they're like, oh my god, how are we gonna get out of here? And Arthur has a brain blast. The ship, the Moth that he had been on, has one room on it that is not actually on the ship. It is connected to a different part of the house. That they and so it was. They describe it at the beginning of the book, and this is a real nice thing where Nix lays something out that feel, just at the time just feels like a cool little bit of world building that he does everywhere, but then comes back to have a purpose. And when he gets on it, he doesn't feel the rocking of the ship. It has a completely different feeling. There's no movement. And then when he walks out into the ship, it's almost super jarring because suddenly it's movement again, and watching it outside of the door. And he's like, we need to get everyone into Captain Caterpillar's room and see what to do, because he thinks like, oh, if we'll be able to get out from there into another, like into the house. And then everybody gets in there, and they get the entire island, all the slaves, all the Feverfew's old pirates. They get everyone out. Like, there's 3,000 flippin' denizens in this room, and they're like, holy shit, how are we gonna get out? The Will helps Arthur use the Atlas, and basically there's a door to the house, to the actual like portal into the house, through Captain Caterpillar's back wardrobe. They have to
So the
remove.
funniest thing is, early on when he first gets in there, Arthur goes, "Oh, where does the wardrobe lead?" And the captain's butler was like, "It just holds his shirts." But no, it actually does lead to somewhere. Like, you can switch where
Yep.
it goes, Narnia style.
It's so interesting. And so they end up having to get everyone out, and there's this point where like they're going in stages so that people don't get stampeded, and Arthur's one of the last ones, and there's this great tense scene where like Skun Scorch has to like throw him up and then jump through with him. But then they end up in water because this portion of the house where this room used to be is underneath the border sea now, because it's part of the flooded old portion of this area. And so they have to like swim up, and they get up, and the Will's like, by the way, I called Wednesday. And everybody's like, you did what? You called Wednesday to come here? Yes, So Arthur can get the whale, and they're like, she's a giant whale that eats people, and the whale's like, surely not. And then the whale's coming, and it's shrinking down, and then it shrinks down and turns into Wednesday as she should look. Like, it's not the shapeless, mushy thing from earlier. It is the beautiful Wednesday of her form, and but her hands are shaking, holding the trident that is her key from the effort it is taking her to keep this form. Arthur gets the trident, and he basically says, like, I remove the curse, and then she collapses because there is nothing inside her. And there's two ways. Again, I like the idea that she'd been like poisoned with nothing earlier, and she was eating so much to keep that at bay. But the other idea is because she ate so much, she just ingested a ton of nothing throughout that time period that is now eating her from the inside out.
I like the idea that she had ingested nothing and that's why she's eating, but what it actually is that Saturday poisoned her. They put nothing in her at some point, and that's why she's dying. There's an idea that's brought up in Sir Thursday and then is also built on more that the something about betraying the will makes them turn into that sin or whatever. And this is also because the will itself tends to be the opposite virtue of whatever their sin is. So like gluttony's I don't remember what they are, but they're kind of the opposites of them, like prudence versus anger or whatever, later on. Because when we're dealing with Sir Thursday, he'll talk about how he can never sleep because the will is always at his ear. It's a snake hissing for justice. And so there's the idea that like she's like that because the will kind of made her like that. But yeah, I like your idea that there's like a seed of nothing in her.
But for me, my thought was that she was poisoned, that it was specifically that she was poisoned by one of the Morrowed days, and that's why it was happening. So I'm partially
To
right.
be honest, you may actually be right. I don't remember things from books great sometimes, guys. You
We'll
may have
see. I
noticed.
don't I And then she dies, and she just turns into like fucking nothing foam, and he has to banish the nothing back into the realm of which it belongs, and it's just like real fucking shit, and there's no emotional beat for this. And not that I expected Arthur to be sad, because he didn't know from a bar of soap, but it would have been such an easy thing to have her Dawn, because her Dawn, even at her worst, loved her lady, you know,
And
and
served
was
her.
like, I know she won't eat me. Like, I believe, like, if she's trying really hard, I know she won't. But like, she served her, and she wanted the best for her lady, and she was helping Arthur for her lady. So it would have been such a small thing to have her Dawn there at the moment of her demise, and to have someone have a reaction, because I was like, that's really shitty. This creature, this, like, she's been alive so long. She was a trustee, and she's dead.
And she tried to do the right thing, and there is a pathos there. It's like with the grotesques when they died. Like, part of it is that, and we'll figure this out in especially in the next book. But like, Garth Nix keeps trying to prune the forest of like too many characters. So like, he keeps having people die who like it actually kind of theoretically would be interesting if they kept going. And so I think this is kind of it. But yeah, you're totally right. There really needed to be more of a capstone on it. It would have been great to have a moment with her mourning with her there. And the thing is, the book is otherwise actually pretty good about Arthur having maybe not intensely emotional reactions to things that happen around him, but still a noticeable reaction to them. Like he, when some of the Piper's children that he becomes friends with dies in Sir Thursday, like he doesn't let that go. That's a thing he thinks. So even just like a few lines being like, "Oh, that's sad," would have been enough. And it's kind of weird that it just isn't. I wonder sometimes how much of these books were ruled by page count, because they're very thin books, so I can imagine that it was something where
For how
Scholastic
much stuff
was
that
like,
happened?
they're very slim, and so I could imagine that it was like, no, there's a hard we're a publisher, there's a hard word limit, you need to cut this or that, but this is it's missing there, and I really, again, I really liked Wednesday. I thought that was such a cool idea.
I really liked Wednesday too. She was really cool. Things wrap up. He basically tells Dame Primus, I'm keeping my key for a little bit. I'm fucking off. And then it goes to what you think is the end of the book, and you think it's Arthur in the hot back in the hospital bed with his parents. But his parents are like, it's so weird. He just put his head in his hands and he won't talk, and he's never reacted to anything like this. And as they turn away, the creature in the bed is the skinless boy pretending to be Arthur, and you're like, oh, that's that thing from the end of the other book that was really creepy, and now it's there, and what the fuck is it doing there? And that brings us to Thursday.
Okay, Thursday is one of my favorite. I had forgotten because, again, it's got military stuff in it. Sir Thursday is the leader of the incomparable army. And the prologue of it is so cool because, okay, basically, Thursday's realm is the something maze. I'm just going to call it the maze. I forget. Basically, it's 1,000 1x1 mile tiles. And the tiles, I can't remember if it's at the end of each day, right? Or...
yes, at sun, when the sun goes down. When the sun goes down.
They randomly switch with other ones in the maze. So they're constantly changing just completely randomly. But the denizens who are there, the army, they know what time they're going to be doing it because they have like an almanac thing. So they know the pattern. And so their job, it's never... when I originally read this, I thought the thing was that they fought the Nithlings here to kind of as a pressure valve to let them out because there's a gate leading to nothing. There's like four big gates and they open it up and Nithlings come in and they fight them and they close the gates, letting them in. But it's apparently not as a pressure valve. It's just to train them, it said.
It's just training. And it's really weird because you would have thought that when the nothing was going to explode in the... second in the far reaches, that would have been a place that the army would have been employed for. But it's the idea that they're supposed to deal with Nithlings, and it's just odd because we've dealt with Nithlings a ton of times at other points.
What do you need an army for? Yeah, what does the architect need an army for?
And it would have made sense if in the first three books we see the troops of the military popping up to deal with Nithling attacks and then fucking off. And then in this book you're like, oh, now we have to go do that thing. But he didn't lay that one out as well as he could have, because you're really like, why did we need an army? Especially because the army doesn't leave the fucking maze. But they can. Like, the lieutenant keeper is part of the army, you figure out. He could have laid this one out better. Despite this, one of my favorite books. I think...
it's so great.
I think Drowned Wednesday is my favorite. And then I think Thursday is second.
Okay, and then where are Tuesday and Monday?
I don't know. I'd have to think about it. They're both
good.
For
me, they're actually in reverse order. Thursday, Wednesday, Tuesday, Monday. I find Monday spends too much time in the real world setting up, like, oh, what's going on? Whereas, like, I just like being in the house and seeing cool shit happen.
You also get way more interesting world building. And once you're used to it in Monday, and I would say, like I said, Monday's the hardest one to, like, swallow. But once you've swallowed it, it really sets you up for the rest to be real easy. And so I would say that. I would say Grim Tuesday as well. But for me, it really just hit its stride in Wednesday and Thursday. Like, the book series is really taking off. It's like, mwah. It's so
Thursday
good.
Is an upping of the stakes. It introduces a bunch of different elements in it that complicate the world and the series as it's going forward that I'll talk about. Anyway, the prologue is like, there's an army guy and he's getting like a weird lieutenant has shown up telling him to let in more Nithlings than normal and the plan has changed. And he like checks his orders and it's correct, but he's like, this is a shitty idea.
And not just more Nithlings than usual. They never open. There's five gates separating them from the nothing that they use to get Nithlings in. Excuse me.
That was so
fucking rude. Fucking rude. But they have five gates. And never once in the history have they opened all five gates at once. There's been one time that they opened four gates for 20 minutes, and that's like considered a long time. The order is, I want you to open all five gates for 24 hours. Straight Nithlings to the face. And it's so insane that he's like, no. And like Will says, he checks with people and they're like, no, those are the orders. Those are the orders. Do it. And if you pay attention, the guy giving this order is named Pervuel. And that's the fucker from that first book who fucked with our boy Arthur and pretended to be one of his knights. And said he was on his side. So Pervuel obviously works for Sunday or Saturday, one of those two assholes.
I love the main character, or not the main character, the lieutenant guy or whoever. I forget his name. But anyway, because there's such a great sense of like, oh, he knows this is a terrible idea, but they follow orders and they're going to do their damned best and they're going to hold out for as long as they can. And it just has such a great pathos to it, which again is funny for the denizens who aren't Like, really, people, again, they're very inflexible people, though the soldiers tend to be somewhat more flexible than the normal ones. They tend to be kind of smarter.
And it's one of those things where, as you go up in ranks, you get the, like, more height and more intelligence, similar, like,
literally more places. Height. When Arthur knighted Pravul, he grew, like, 2 inches. Or no, that was Jazbeth in the second book, I think.
Japheth. But, God, we didn't even mention him. Why do I remember all of this? I don't need all of this in my brain. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, we also forgot the part where Japheth, who's a thesaurus, so when he's nervous, he just says a bunch of different words. And then later, he starts writing a chronicle of Arthur that talks about how incredibly tall and handsome he is, and he has an assassin by his side named Blue. And he goes around with, like, a bear, who's the whale, which is just always fun. A
grizzly frog bear? Yeah, it's crazy. And so none of the sailors thought Arthur was the heir to the house because he didn't look like what the story was described as. That's what happens. When you spin the PR too much, you can go too far. But anyway, and basically what happens at the beginning of this book is Arthur tries to get back to his realm. Everybody's like, you can't go back with the key. It needs to be here. You're going to fuck shit up. And he goes, no, I'm just going to go back for 2 seconds, make sure everything is fine. And then I'll pop back. And people are trying to stop him, but he tries to, and the lieutenant keeper is like, you can't do that. There is already something filling your space in the secondary realms. And Arthur's like, what do you mean there's something filling my space in the secondary realms? And the lieutenant keeper is like, shit's going down. I can't have this conversation right now. And he fucks off. And then Dame Primus comes up and is like, yo, we need to have a meeting. You can't fuck off. And they basically have a briefing where he learns about the skinless boy, and the skinless boy is a creation, a type of Nithling that is created to mimic and become someone else and take on the form of someone else, and it does this by also taking over people's minds to get more information about the person that they are imitating, but also to control the people that it does, and it does this through like a mold that it infects other people with. And Arthur's like, oh no, this is terrible. It's gonna infect my family. It probably has already infected my family because all it has to do is touch them, and yet you fucking infected. And he's like, I have to deal with that. And they're like, you can't. It's taking your space. Like, there's only one Arthur tile in the secondary realms, and it's filling it. You can't do it. And his friend Leif, who has been a ship's boy for the past like 3 months because time works funky in the house, it's like, I'll go do it. I'll try deal with it. And basically, they had to have a piece of Arthur's clothing, and it was the pocket that I mentioned that the Fetchers ripped off in the first book. And that's what they're using as the item to generate this creature. And it's hidden it somewhere safe. And they use the book, the Atlas, to find out where its lair is. Another thing that is happening is at the end of the previous book, that's when Arthur, because Scamandros goes, there's a lot of magic in you. Like, you're mortal, but there's a lot of magic in you. Like, I can't do some stuff because of how much magic has infected you. And basically, that's when Arthur learns that the more that he uses the keys, the more he interacts with this magic stuff, the more it's turning him into a denizen. And eventually, there's a no point, like a no-go zone or a point of no return. That he can't come back from. So Dr. Scamandros gives him a ring that is a snake eating itself. And when it's 6/10 gold, yeah, it changes from gold to silver. When it's 6/10 gold, he will not be able to turn back into a human. And he puts it on and he's at 4.
Anytime he uses any of the keys, it's going to continue to increase. And so at one point, he actually didn't even want to open the Atlas and ask it anything because he didn't know what was going to happen. And this is one of the elements that complicates the book. Because again, we had a status quo, and then this is like, oh no, he can't use magic anymore. Because Scamandros is like, no, it should wear off soon. Only a couple hundred centuries. Like, only a couple centuries and it should be on and it'll be back to its normal levels. And like, that's obviously just not gonna work. We also forgot to mention it because it's not important, but he has Scamandros gave him a brace that's a crab shell, that's a crab leg, and it's just like the coolest thing, and he's wearing it all the time because his fancy one got broken.
He basically is like, okay, we're gonna send Leif in. They give Leif some clothing so that she doesn't look like a fucking ship's boy
from another, like, another world too. It looks like blue jeans, but it isn't. It's one from the other secondary realms,
and it's a band t-shirt, but it's not a band that exists in our earth.
Yeah, it's so funny. It's interesting because like there's always this thing where, like, if you're a cosmic being, why would you pay attention to Earth? But you know why? And I thought about it this time. The Fermi paradox. millions and millions and millions of stars, and yet we've seen no hit, like there aren't any other aliens around, and it's because life is just incredibly rare. And so it makes sense that even in this celestial structure that oversees all the universe, oh yeah, they are weirdly a creative little species compared to like all the other non-sentient species there are.
And they comment on that a lot of the universes and worlds have no life on them. They're just places,
Yeah,
rocks.
they're just always there. And so the thing is, and there's this funny thing about how Dame Primus wanted to start the list of things they needed to get done sequentially, which was just like a bunch of
Alphabetically,
bureaucracy
yeah.
alphabetically. And then Martha was like, no, let's do it by importance. And she's like really pissed about it because she's just getting increasingly annoyed at his unwillingness to shed his mortal trappings and become the inheritor of the will. And like he even starts to feel it kind of fill him. He like doesn't like to look her in the eye. And then under the table during this meeting is Cersei Turquoise Blue, who will stab him with like a needle if he starts getting too out of it. And she stabs Dame Primus, but it destroys the needle and she doesn't even notice.
And it's hysterical because there's points where it doesn't say Susie said, it says said the voice under the table. And you're just like this entire serious meeting that everybody's taking super seriously. Susie's just under the fucking table. Oh God, she's so great. And basically, in the middle of this meeting, as they're getting ready to move on to like the new reprioritized list, a letter comes saying that Arthur has been enlisted in the army of the architect, and he's like, "Well, I can't. I'm Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday now." And they were like, "No, you have to. They served their time." And he's like, "No, I don't have." And they were like, he was like, "How long's the term?" And they're like, "100 years." And he's like, "I do not have time for this." And she was like, "Actually." Primus is like, this is actually good. We needed a safe place to keep you while we're dealing with some of the other stuff, and you don't want to deal with some of this. So it's, and he was like, well, can I take the key? And they were like, no, they will repossess anything you take with you. So you need to pass that over to me. And then she's like, and then I'll go fix the oceans. Because he's like, there's a lot of things that need to be done to fix the house that somebody with a key has to do that Arthur has no interest in doing. Like, the border sea needs to be brought back within its actual borders to stop people going in and out of the secondary realms when they're not supposed to be. The whole point that Fever, the whole reason Feverfew was able to get here, and I think it's the Bermuda Triangle.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, I think the idea is that the Bermuda Triangle is where the border sea touched our world, and so Feverfew was able to get to the secondary realms or get to the house through that, and by staying too much, he ended up becoming he learned sorcery and magic and became the weird thing he did. But like that needs to be done, and he can't just fuck off, and he doesn't want to do it. And this is also the first time where Dame Primus is like, oh yes, just give me the key, because all the other times when he's been like, I don't want to take it, she's been like, this really is most irregular, like you need to take it. And then she was like, it's almost like she was like, and then Arthur gave me the key, check, thing done on the list of things to do. And you're like, is this a little stir of Dame Primus maybe getting a little too used to power?
Again, complicating the series. But yeah, so he's been enlisted. He can't say no. So he gets taken by a lieutenant back to Sir Thursday's camp. Basically, once he's there, he changes his name so they won't know it's him. There's a lot of like military boot camp stuff that's fun. There actually isn't a ton of it, but it's fun what's there. And what happens is he meets another, or not another, he meets a Piper's child called Fred. Oh, they always have the coolest last names, but I forget what it is. Fred Gold, like Inlay or something like that. Basically, what happens though is they are going to get washed behind the ears, which again is what happens when they get mind wiped. And they try to escape it, and it doesn't work. And there's the people who show up to do it are like super creepy angel looking things without faces that like send a snake of thing of to coil around him so that they can put a crown on his head that'll wipe his. It's actually again really dark for a children's book, but it just doesn't feel it. Or you wouldn't notice as a child.
And they tried to write notes to themselves to help jog their memories, and his has to be cryptic because, like, God forbid somebody else finds the note, so he can't just write, "You're Arthur Penhaligon, you're the heir to the house, and you're Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday." But like, he can't write that because that's if somebody else finds. Because literally, when he has his first day of boot camp, the lieutenant who's in charge of him, or I think it's Colonel, I don't know, it's a higher up guy, is like, "Listen, buddy, heart to heart. You don't want people to know who you are. It's, we can't treat you like you're different. So it's best for you if we just give you a fake
name. I dislike politics.
I dislike politics. We're going to pretend we never had this conversation. From now on, you're called Green. And so Arthur knows that it's for the best that he does. So he like tries writing it too. And so when he wakes up the next day with no recollection of what happened and who he is or what he is, he's got this note saying, like, his name isn't his real name, and it says AP, and he's like, what the fuck is AP? Meanwhile, Fred is putting stuff together and remembering things, but Arthur becomes a really good soldier, and we miss a lot of his training from him going from bumbling to successful, but it works.
And the army has four different segments. It has the Legion, who are just Romans. It has the Horde, who are very clearly Mongolian. It has the Regiment, which is like the British Napoleonic War one. And then the moderately honorable artillery.
Artillery.
Which is the funniest thing in the world. And it's not commented on until the end, but it's just a funny joke whole time.
It's hysterical.
And I just love that. Again, it's such a mishmash of like, they literally were just like, let's take this and take that. And there wasn't really any understanding of why or what. But yeah, Arthur has been mind wiped. He becomes a good soldier over 6 weeks. This whole time, Leaf is now, there's a whole plot with Leaf in the world trying to get to defeat the skinless boy. Basically, it's very creepy because it's very Invasion of the Body Snatchers, because when the skinless boy he infects you with a mold if he touches you, and then he takes control of your mind. There's a point where the army opens fire on a bunch of civilians off screen who are trying to get out of the hospital because they've been mind taken over. And you're like, again, this is a children's book? That was crazy.
That's insane. And it's the best secondary, like it's the best B plot of what's happening in the real world, because it's the stakes. And then at one point she gets infected by the mind mold, and she knows she only has a certain amount of time, and she ends up getting the like pocket, and she has to get it out, but there's a quarantine. Like, it's just so fucking intense. But she ends up getting it to Susie gets it from her from the secondary realms and has to knock her out because like her arm is like trying to work against her.
There's this great bit about where she gets this old lady to help her, which I mentioned earlier, and she's so funny because she takes an ambulance hostage by very loudly saying things that she heard in her television programs, which is just, it's very funny. It's great. So there's some stuff that happens. There's a battle in that Arthur goes through, and it's good. It reminds me a bit of Diana Wynne Jones in that it's just a very inglorious battle that's very messy and kind of he's not happy about. And basically what's been happening is that ever since they opened those five gates, they left in like a huge amount of Nithlings, but these Nithlings are weird. They're not just like normal weird monster orc Nithlings. These are like Uruk-hai. Like, they're organized, they march, they have drums. Everybody's like kind of weirded out by it,
and they mainly look like denizens. They don't have the weird inconsistencies that Nithlings normally do. They like, there's some extra like tentacles and stuff, but for the most part they just kind of look like weird looking denizens. And they call them the new Nithlings, and they're organized, and they've got platoons, and like, everybody's like, the fuck is this?
Like, everybody's very worried, but they're like, we'll just depend upon tectonic strategy, which is that they lure them onto different squares so that they can be destroyed piecemeal by organized denizen forces while they're disorganized. But they're like, this is kind of weird. And then one of the people, and you hear about how the guy in the prologue, he ended up dying, but he held out long enough to close the doors after that 24-hour period. And you're like, oh, he made it. Or, he didn't make it, but he did his thing. And they see this giant, like, spike of nothing coming out through the gates and heading towards the center of the maze. And they're like, that's weird. A, how do they know this is going to end up being on square 505, which is the center of the maze?
500.
And I'm like, what is this spike? And so at some point, Arthur and Fred get called, because all of the Piper's children are going to get called to the main Citadel, where Sir Thursday rules. And like, there's some stuff that happens on the way there. And then as they're about to cross over, two of the tiles were supposed to slide apart, at night, and then all of a sudden they didn't, and they're like, whoa, what happened? That's never happened before. And when they see the Citadel, it's like this massive structure or whatever, and they see plumes of smoke over it and everything, and Firewash is what they call it, and it's being besieged by just a massive army of these new Nithlings. Because now these Nithlings, what happened is that spike in the center of the maze made it so that none of the tiles can shift anymore, and so now they can organize to get there all at once. And Arthur gets taken in, and by this point he's remembered who he is, and we meet Sir Thursday. And Sir Thursday, when I first read this book, I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. The voice the narrator gives him is great.
It's fantastic.
It's so mean and just petty and like non-British is the funniest part. It's the one character who has like a almost not an American accent, but like almost a little bit. And Sir Thursday isn't as large as you would think. He's kind of small, but he's mad all the time.
And his uniform isn't even, it's almost like a normal recruit uniform. It's not even like one of the cool ones, but it's got like seven epaulets on it, and he's got anger issues, and he gets so angry that he like and because he's explaining the situation that he'd been tricked, that he the Morrow Days told him to do this thing, but they let new Nithlings in, and then somehow they exploited the fact that if you stab a spear through square 500, 500, and now his entire the maze and the house is at risk, and he's just super angry, and he's like, "So I'm taking you fucking Piper's children with me up the improbable stairs, and we're gonna deal with this spike." And Arthur's like, "Perfect." Susie appeared, and Susie's like, "By the way, I have the pocket." She re-enlisted. She was in the reserves. And so they all get, and basically Thursday knows that.
Yeah, he has a conversation with Arthur where he's like, "I know who you are now. I can't do anything though because you're one of my soldiers, but you also can't do anything against me. I just follow orders. I follow Sir Lord Sunday's command via Saturday." One of the cool things about this book is it really builds up Lord Sunday as like this really figure of dread in the distance. Like Saturday is always the one doing stuff, but everybody talks about
About
Sunday,
Sunday.
and it's like he's one of the children of the old one and the architect. Like,
And the eldest.
and so they go on this improbable stair. The reason they do that is because denizens can't really go up the stairs; they get distracted. Whereas Piper's children can kind of keep like around. But basically, they're like SEAL Team Piper, and they go and they get to the spike, and Sir Thursday starts to cut it. And right as the new Nithlings are about to attack, Arthur hears a sound of like a pipe, and then all of the Piper's children go still. And Sir Thursday gets pissed about this. He's like, "You traitors!" And he literally kills two of them in his anger, which, like, again, hardcore. This is a book where people die, like, just
Yes.
on their own. And I don't know if we figured out now or later, but basically, do we figure it out now or later?
So, I mean, you figure it out now because there was a someone with a head made out of metal, and Arthur couldn't tell if it was a mask or just in place of a head. And this guy who had been the leader of the new Nithling army comes up, and he's playing a pipe. So immediately, it doesn't. The book doesn't say it was the piper, but it's a dude playing a pipe, and the piper's children have gone quiet, and you're like, it's the fucking Piper. But they don't have a chance to really talk to him in this moment. And the Thursday's plan isn't working. So he's gonna go jump up the improbable stairs. And Arthur's like, "Not today, motherfucker." He throws the pocket into the nothing spike because to destroy the skinless boy, he has to. And I will say that this was a really anticlimactic ending for this plot line. He throws, like, he jumps on Sir Thursday, and as he's jumping on Thursday to follow him up the improbable stairs, because you have to be touching the person going up, he throws the pocket into the spike of nothing in the hopes that that will destroy the skinless boy, and they fuck off. They've left the Piper's children in this place, and you're immediately like, "But Susie!"
Susie!
They go back, and Thursday's like, "Arrest him. He's a traitor, blah blah blah." And Arthur's like, "No, he literally killed two of his soldiers. They were the Piper was there, and the Piper's children froze. This needs to be investigated." And Thursday's Dawn, Dune, and Dusk, Dawn, Noon, and Dusk are like, "This is indeed a serious inquiry. We must do. We must follow protocol and look into this." And Thursday's like, "No, kill him." And the part of the will that is on like Thursday's is speaking to Arthur through his mind, and is like, "Make him angry. If you make him angry, I can escape." And so Arthur's like kind of helping instigate, but he's getting real mad. And then his Dawn, Noon, and Dusk have to like fight him to defend Arthur at a certain point. And then there's this point where he's gonna go attack Arthur, and the snake that is wrapped around. So basically, the will is not hidden somewhere else for once. There's no fetch quest. The will is just on the key. He combined the will onto the key, and that's where he's been holding the will. And so the will uses its opportunity to escape, helps Arthur, like attaches himself to Arthur, and then they get the key, and Thursday's like super pissed and still really powerful. This is the first time where after the key has been taken, the person doesn't just like become a non-issue. Thursday's still fucking annoying, but Arthur has him arrested. And he's like, okay, we have to deal with this. And he asks Thursday's Noon, like, what are we doing, buddy? Like, how's it looking? And he's like, it's not good. It's and he was like, Arthur's like, we're gonna try diplomacy. I wanna talk to the Piper and see what we can work out. And he goes, but you should do diplomacy from a point of power. He has a brother who's in the military who's said stuff around
Stand
Arthur
easy
before.
versus easy stand. Or no, it was stand easy versus something else.
At ease.
At ease, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, his brother said there was a difference, and then he couldn't remember what it was when
Which
the
one was
military guy
which?
told him.
Like,
Yeah, which I, for some reason, that stuck with me when I since I first read it. I've always been like, is it stand at ease or stand easy? And then again, I couldn't remember which is which either. He goes to speak with the leader of, well, okay, so first he calls up, he's like, Dame Primus, send every person who can ever fight anybody to come and help out here. And then he's gonna go talk to the leader of the new Nithlings, and he's like, he's got the piece of the will with him, which is a snake, but the snake is really focused on justice. Like, it's like, well, we need to deal with Sir Thursday first. Like, we shouldn't do. And he's like, okay, stop it, we gotta do this. Also, while I'm going to meet with this guy, don't bite him. It's again an example of Nyx being like, this is a trope. This is not what we're like, we're taking precautions against it. So he goes and talks to the leader, and the leader, right, is the Piper. But the Piper has basically, he got thrown into nothingness for 700 years ago by Sunday. And so his body has just been like eaten away into almost nothingness, hilariously enough. But because he was one of the children of the architect in the old one, he's like he couldn't really quite be destroyed. And so he built a little pocket universe for himself. And in the pocket universe, over time, he created these new Nithlings who are more human than Denizen, in that they're creative, they're smarter. And like now, this whole thing has been his plan to get out and reconquer the house. And he's like, look, you are the inheritor, but not, you don't want to be. Give me the keys.
And he's also like, I'm the legitimate heir. I'm the son of the architect. And then I think the will was like, well, then technically, wouldn't Sunday actually be the inheritor? Like, your logic is flawed, my guy. And he basically tells Arthur, I will let you go, live your normal life, do whatever you want, but you have to give me the key. And Arthur's like, are you going to not fuck around with the secondary realms? Like, are you just gonna leave everything? And he's like, no, I'm gonna do what I want. Like, if I feel like fucking around, I'll fuck around. And Arthur's like, no, fuck you. This is not what we're doing. Tis war.
And then the snake spits venom into his face, and Arthur's like, I told you not to do that. And he said, no, you told me not to bite him. And he's like, get out of here, which is just so funny.
It's so
But then
good.
they have the battle. It's very hopeless. The thing is that Arthur doesn't want to use the key's power, because if he uses, he's almost at that six mark where there's no going back. And then eventually Dame Primus shows up and kills a bunch of people. The Nithlings are defeated. But Arthur realizes that he ended up using too much magic. He got just to five, and like that was, maybe we don't know what's gonna happen
Way
next.
more than he wanted. He didn't want it to go above four. He was trying really hard. And so you really get the idea that the next book is going to be him reckoning with his what is he going to do with this? Like, how is he going to deal with it? And I haven't read past this, I don't think. I have no recollection. I might start reading it and be like, oh, I do actually remember. If I did, I read Friday and I definitely didn't read the other two. Oh, it also ends with
So creepy. Leith is back in the hospital, and they're like, oh, okay, how are you doing? Are there, and she's like, I'm recovering, whatever. And they're like,
oh no, she's throwing up the mold.
right.
She's
That was
literally.
me saying a moment. It was okay.
Oh. She, it's a gross scene. She's throwing up all the mind mold that was inside her. And then they were like, oh, this new doctor's, she'll be here to see you in a second. She's really great. And they were like, oh, what's the doctor's name? And because she asked, what day of the week is it? And they were like, it's Friday. And you, as the reader, are like, oh,
Oh,
shit.
no.
It's Friday. That means we got. And then the doctor's like, funnily, or the nurse is like, funnily enough, our doctor's name is Friday. And she's just called Lady Friday. You know, we all call her that. She's really smart. And you're like, oh, no.
It's such a great cliffhanger. I love this series. Like, it was just so enjoyable to read. I love the world building. His writing is really great. Again, there could be more depth to everything. Like, this story could be deeper than it is. But also, we have read so many stories that just fail at some of the basics that, like, this is such a fresh breath of air.
It was just fun. It was just,
I just
it
wanted to
was a
read
romp a
more.
romp.
It's sad that, like, like nobody knows these and nobody will watch this video. But yeah, I think we should definitely do the next three. I didn't think we were going to because again, this video would do poorly and that one will do worse. But fuck it, we have a Patreon, guys. Go join our Patreon. You support independent journalism. You let this stuff happen.
We'll do it.
The next three should be good because I do remember what happens and it is interesting because there's gonna be more stuff to talk about because I think the
Yes.
last book is where it all like falls apart a little bit. But maybe I'll feel differently now.
I'm interested. I have to say that young William generally has some decent takes, so I'd be surprised if you actually have a completely different idea of it, but we'll see.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I've heard other people complain about it online, so
Yeah.
like I'm not totally alone. But yeah, and then we'll find another excuse to do more Garth Nix at some point in the future.
So, and some Diana Wynne Jones.
I do want to do more of hers, even if I know they don't really have audiobooks for some of them, but I really do want to do the not three parts dead, the one with the dead sisters and also the one about the dog
Oh.
star. I kind of want to do a little bit. But that's again, Patreon is what allows us to do this. We don't have to chase the algorithm. We don't have to read more Fourth Wing. So join our Patreon. Also like this video. It's free and it actually does help the channel. I know everybody says that, but it does. It's called engagement.
Go read it if you want a good time. And if you don't. I don't care. Live your life.
We're not your parents.
We love you, our parasocial darlings. Yeah. Bye.